And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about organizing in Pennsylvania. Well, soon to be outlawed if the GOP gets his way, as they try to make talking to your coworkers, they're going to make that stalking. But if your employer sends out a surveillance team, that's just fine. They're just keeping an eye on you because they care. Also going to talk about baseball, football, concussions, suspensions, and so much more in the world of sports, drugs, steroids, all of that as well. Also more on the sale of the Washington Post to the head of Amazon. Well, will we see more charter? Will we see more for-profit schools, more education for profit? I believe so. Also, the 40th annual ALEC conference in Chicago, going to hit up on that, and more fun with guns. Gotta love the gun stories. Stupid people shooting themselves in the foot. And a guy who said, oh, they took my property, I'm going to go shoot a bunch of people. Which, I got to be honest, I'm surprised the story in Ross Township didn't get a much bigger exposure. You got a crazy guy who was basically a hoarder. Everyone loves watching the hoarding show on TV. So you've got a hoarder living next door to you. You want the township to do something. They do something. And the guy goes and shoots a bunch of people. And at the arraignment goes, well, you know, I'm sorry for the people who got killed because they weren't the ones who did it to me. And I'm going, wait a second. You know, if you're going to go and do that, at least go get the people who actually did it to you. Not innocent bystanders or the neighbors who complained. What's amazing to me is he told his father, and his father, that's basically nothing. I don't know. Anyway, your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So, it was July 15th, the first time we talked about the Empowering Opportunities Gateways Out of Poverty initiative proposed by the chairman of the Republican Policy Committee, Representative Dave Reed. And I've been waiting. I eagerly check their website daily. I go to their Facebook page. I've been checking every day going, okay, you had the big announcement, the big rollout. You had the poverty simulation, you know, because we want to be able to figure out what poor people do. So they had the little play poverty for a while thing on the 15th. And then nothing. I've been waiting the 16th, 17th, 18th, nothing, 20th, 25th, nothing, 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 nothing. Finally a post today. Evidently, yesterday, they held a little get-together at Lock Haven University. And they had a couple of speakers come in. I don't know if there were any real people who were living in poverty there. I don't know if they actually talked to poor people. But they had people who might know some poor people. A number of groups came in and gave presentations there in Clearfield County. At the Lock Haven University. And from the reports, maybe just talking to someone about poor people, maybe it will open the eyes of some of the Republicans. Now understand, the center of the state of Pennsylvania is a very red area. A lot of Republicans here. Also a lot of poverty. Understand, the statewide average, the number of people statewide, the percentage, about 13.7% of the population of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania lives in poverty. About 13.7%. In Clearfield County, where this was, you're talking about almost 15%. In Center County, you're talking about almost 20%. Jefferson County, almost 15%. And you go down the list, I mean, a lot of these rural areas, very high poverty. Because what we know, without exception, is that, you know, we think poverty inner city, reality, little reality check, poverty rural areas. In fact, much higher percentages of poverty in the rural areas, and also less services to help those in poverty. So it was interesting to me that the Republicans from the rural areas are saying, we're going to go on a poverty listening tour, where you go, really? When you look at Center County and you go, well, you know, almost 20% of the people in Center County are technically in the poverty range. Can you explain how you didn't already know that? In Clearfield County, where they had the little poverty meeting. And, you know, there are a number of representatives there. Dave Reed, obviously the chairman. He was there from Indiana County. Republican Representative Tommy Sankey was there from Clearfield. Representative Adam Harris, Republican. Also Donna Oberlander, also a Republican, there at the little event. And I'm surprised that was it. That's all you got. But, you know, you still got, you know, a handful of people to show up. And I guess good for them. But in Clearfield County, where they have this little shindig, almost 21% of the population of Clearfield County, where they had this, are eligible for Medicare or Medicaid. And for me, I'm going, well, wait a second. You know, isn't this a great opportunity to highlight the fact that the Republicans, of which all of them were, are dead set against the Medicaid expansion, which would help the people in that area. And help the people mightily in the center of the state. So, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm going, well, you know, I think this may actually backfire on the Republicans as they go, well, we didn't know there was poverty in our, we obviously don't know our constituents. Now, one of the guys who spoke, a guy named Barry Dank, he was from the Center for Rural Pennsylvania. A research agency, they say, for the General Assembly. He gave a little presentation. He said, you know, the working poor of the Commonwealth, the working poor of Pennsylvania, are defined, you know, as people who are employed. They work more than 10 hours a week. They're 18 years or older, and their total household income is less than 150% of the poverty level. Which in Pennsylvania for a family of three in 2011 was over $26,000. They pointed out that 77% of the rural working poor live with other people. 54% of them have children under the age of 18, and 53% of them rent. And for 53% of them, their rent was approximately 46% of their total income. So you stop and you think about this and you go, wow, really? 60% are employed. Median household income in Pennsylvania, about $18,400. We are 43rd in the nation with the percentage of working poor. So I found it interesting that, okay, you've got this guy who's told these Republicans, how do they respond? Well, they respond with anecdotal tales. Representative Sankey. Says, well, you know, I saw a letter to the editor once, you know, said that, you know, the reason they were in poverty, because remember, Chairman Reed has said that, you know, it's a bad decision or one bad situation that puts people into poverty, you know, like being born. Well, Sankey said, well, I read this letter once, and, you know, this woman said that her and her daughter-in-law, they were working, and they didn't take an extra hours or an extra job because it would hurt them because, you know, the assistance they get would offset the extra hours, so they didn't do it. And I'm going, well, hold on a second, Rep. It's your party. It's you guys who mandate this stuff. It's you guys who are the ones who put the roadblocks in the way so that those people, and now you're finding out, oh, it's my people. Oops. So that those people don't abuse the system. What I found extremely interesting, though, is in Chairman Reed's little piece, I'm sure that he's been pimping around in the newspapers. He wrote, it's been estimated the federal government spends more than $1 trillion annually on programs to help the poor. He said, with approximately 46 million Americans living in poverty, that's enough in tax dollars to actually provide every low-income family of four with about $87,000 in cash each year. I'm going, yeah, if you do the simplistic math like that, sure, you're right. Correct. But we don't do that because that would be rewarding sloth and indifference and laziness and poor people. They're all of those things. The reality is, Chairman, and this is something I've been screaming about for years, all of those programs that you keep talking about, they seem to benefit your corporate buddies. If we were to do a lot of this stuff for ourselves instead of privatizing everything and putting a profit motive to everything, it would be substantially less. So what I'm looking at as I'm going, you know, maybe by having this tour, maybe their eyes are opening at some point and they're going, well, you know, maybe we could do things a little bit differently. Maybe, you know, who knows? Thoughts? And then I look at Representative Oberlander's statement, who said that she had read recently some research that said in order for someone to get the needed benefits that they would need to have to, you know, to live a living wage kind of lifestyle, they'd need to make $22 an hour. And where can you find a job paying that much, she asked. And I'm going, hello? Remember you guys, 2010, said we're the party of jobs? Where the hell are the jobs? 2012 said kind of the same thing, almost. Where are the jobs? No transportation bill. You're going gallivant all over the state. Where are the jobs? You're right. Where are they? And, oh, by the way, had you allowed the minimum wage to continue to go up with inflation from the 1960s to forward today, minimum wage, had it kept up with productivity and had it kept up with the way things were going, would probably be close to $22 an hour. And what's interesting to me is a couple of the representatives said, well, you know, it's just one thing that puts people into poverty, you know, like their car breaking down or something, you know, that just leads to disaster. So we need to figure out how to do that. No, it's a systematic problem. It goes from housing to transportation to education to all of these things that I'm sorry to say, and I'm sorry to point out for those who don't want to hear it, but all of the things that the Republicans have been blocking for the last couple of years, all of the things that they've been defunding for the last couple of years, it's making poverty worse. So to me, it seems extraordinarily disingenuous to say, oh, we care about poverty and we're going to go on this poverty tour because we want to help lift people out of poverty. It's what you're doing that's making poverty worse. So you may say, oh, we're going to offer fresh solutions. Yes, we want churches to do more. Yeah, I want churches to do more, too. Would love to see that. Not going to happen, though. And for me, I look at the chairman when he says, well, you know, Johnson had the war on poverty, and, you know, we need to look at that. Because, you know, back then, one in five citizens were living in poverty, and today you got one in four. Yeah, you know why? Your policies. As head of the policy committee, how about a policy that's going to promote full employment? How about a policy that's going to invest in roads and bridges? How about a policy that's going to invest in education? How about a policy that's going to invest in health care? How about a policy that's going to invest in affordable housing? How about a policy that's going to help families afford college, afford pre-K programs, afford to take a day off occasionally by making sure that there's some paid sick days when they're sick? How about a bunch of policies? Instead of going on this feel-good, oh, we want to see what poverty looks like, nonsensical tour, how about actually proposing some tangible policies that are going to make things better instead of what they have done, which is make things worse? When you don't allow the minimum wage to be raised, you are making poverty worse. When you're taking cops off the streets in high poverty areas, you are making suffering and poverty worse. When you eliminate the general assistance budget that helped the neediest of the needy in our Commonwealth, when you eviscerate and you destroy that program, you have made poverty and suffering worse. When you kick 41,000 low-wage workers off of adult basic, you have made poverty and suffering much worse. When you kick 89,000 kids off of Medicare, off the CHIP program, you are making poverty worse. And when you steal $3 billion from education so that you can give it out in tax handouts to big corporations who aren't in turn creating jobs that are paying $22 an hour, you are in fact making poverty worse. And when you kick 20,000 education professionals to the curb who were making somewhere around 20, you are not only making their poverty worse, but their communities worse off because you're taking that money out of the communities. So don't tell me, oh, we're going on this grand listening tour because we care. when everything you have done has made poverty that much worse. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Since 2008, IATSE Local 5 has been putting pressure on the Bank of Kentucky Center at Northern Kentucky University to pay wages comparable to other performing arts centers and arenas in the region. According to IATSE's Tom Gadooly, the center has been bringing in workers from Columbus, Ohio, who they can pay lower wages.
A university put out to bid a contract with this company called SMG. And as such, they lost all of the rights. So the university is not happy with this situation. The Bank of Kentucky, which is actually the naming sponsor, isn't happy with this situation. Our organization, who gives scholarships and recruits students from that university, isn't happy with this situation. And the company that's running it could care less.
Gadooly said IATSE sought to work with the company managing the facility with the understanding that it is a smaller facility with a tighter budget than some of the larger performing arts venues in the area. He said the negotiations broke down with the company deciding it would be simpler to outsource the work.
And in the end, they just felt that it was easier and they could pay people a lot less, travel from Columbus, Ohio, to come into our jurisdiction and take tax dollars away from our local community. This is harmful to our community and our partners, other venues that actually do the right thing in our community.
St. Louis low-wage workers have support from around Missouri for their Can't Survive on 735 campaign. Doug Cunningham reports.
The battles for higher wages and union rights being waged around the country by fast food workers, retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and port workers is part of a dynamic new low-wage worker movement in America. From New York City to St. Louis, from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit, and to L.A. and beyond, workers assisted by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW are standing up for higher wages and the right to form unions. Martine Raffanon is with the St. Louis Workers Organizing Committee in the St. Louis Can't Survive on 735 campaign.
We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So Representative Stephen Bloom, my state representative, back in the news. He's circulating a co-sponsorship memo, wants to teach creationism in our schools. And you can call it any name you want, back to the creationism stuff. And, you know, at a time where, the rest of his party seems to be running around trying to find poverty because, oh, we care about the poor, even though our policies have made things worse. You got Stephen Bloom, who's, I don't really care so much about poverty. We've got our agenda. Just Absolutely mind-blowing. Anyway, here to talk to us a little bit about that. Also, the war on workers is our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here. How are you, Rick?
I am good. I'm looking at my state representative, who nobody really is going to run against. He's probably going to run unopposed this next time again, who is probably one of the most radical guys in the House that nobody really knows about.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the amazing things about people like Representative Bloom and others of his ilk is that they go home and they speak to their constituents and talk about how they want to make government be reined in, to tame the wild government beast. And then they come back here to Harrisburg and they propose legislation that makes government bigger, imposes more activity of government on our lives, on our children, on our schools, on our very way of life, and I'm having trouble reconciling it. Get a guy like Bloom who, you know, talks about government ought to be smaller and government ought to be less and government costs too much and it's our tax dollars, and he's one of the most profuse and profligate recipients of taxpayer funding. Every year he gets something in the range of, I don't know, whatever that legislative salary is, $80,000 to $90,000 a year. And on top of that, every time he comes to work, when they come to Harrisburg for a committee meeting or a session or a token session, they get paid a daily rate, and he gets a car allowance, and he gets an office, and he gets an office back home, and he gets a staff, all of which are paid for with my taxes and your taxes. And he then says the government's too big and government costs too much. I haven't seen him suggest that he was going to step up to the plate and stop taking his pay.
Yeah. You know, I look at this poverty tour, and I don't know if you've been following Chairman Reed's poverty tour across the state. You know, I've been waiting for it. They announced the big policy initiative on July 15th, finally had their first little foray into looking into poverty yesterday in Clearfield County at the Lock Haven University, where they evidently
were... At Clinton County.
Okay, well, the report said Clearfield. Okay, so it was at the Clearfield campus.
Oh, okay.
Lock Haven University.
Lock Haven University is in Lock Haven, which is Clinton County. But forgive me, I digress.
Yeah, it was the Clearfield campus.
So gotcha.
Thank you for the. And they point out that, you know, there's high poverty in rural areas. First time since July 15th, and one of the statements that I found very interesting, and I wanted to get your thought on, Chairman Reed put in his piece that the federal government spends about more than $1 trillion a year on programs to help, you know, those poor people, and he said there are about 46 million poor people, and if we would just divide that up, it would be about $87,000 in cash for each one of those people. And I'm going, well, if we're spending that money on poverty, why is it still here?
Well, you know, it's hard to imagine. First of all, it's hard to imagine, and I wonder how much they spent from July 15th to August 6th to find out that there's rural poverty in Clearfield County. When I was a college student at Penn State, I used to go to Clearfield County one day every week for an entire school year to help people who were living then in rural poverty in Clearfield County, just above Sutter County, where Penn State is located, where I went to school. And I didn't need anybody to go on a tour. I didn't need a press release. I didn't need a taxpayer-funded car or a taxpayer-funded van or a taxpayer-funded van or, you know, bus or whatever it was to go discover what everybody knew. And instead of wasting that money so that they could put out one more press release, maybe they should have bought some food for some of the kids up in Clearfield County who live in rural poverty and know the pain and anguish of a household, not where the breadwinner is out of work, but where the breadwinner works and can't earn enough to support his or her family. There's a war on poverty. These people are waging it, people like Representative Reed, and they're beating the people in poverty. They're not beating poverty. This is a sad and sick joke, Rick. There's a war on poverty. Poverty won.
And it's the policies put forth by these folks. In my view, it's the policies that they've put forth, the theft of education, the theft of health care, the theft of opportunity, the theft of investment in infrastructure and in the future, to me, that has made this all that much worse. And one of the interesting stories I got from the report of yesterday's big anti-poverty or, poverty listening tour was by Representative Oberlander. Who said that she had read a story somewhere that in order for someone to, not live in poverty and, kind of live a normal life, they need to make $22 an hour. And she questioned, well, where do you find a job paying that?
Well, I know one place. Run for the General Assembly. Based on the amount of work that some of those people do, $22 an hour is a dramatic pay cut. Now, that doesn't speak for every member of the General Assembly. The vast majority are hardworking people, dedicated men and women who really and truly, regardless of party affiliation, are committed to the notion of representing their constituencies. But I got some, that we can easily identify who don't do enough work to justify their salaries, much less, the diminished amount of only $22 an hour. So, I know where to find one of those jobs. And I encourage our listeners to find him, too.
I'm right there with you. I'm hoping – I had toyed with the idea of running against Representative Bloom, but, the reality is I don't want to give this up to have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that whoever does, I'm willing to help. But at the end of this, I go back to the reality of, $22 an hour sounds like a decent job and it should be available for folks. And that's why I go back to my view that workers should have the ability to collectively bargain and to join and form unions to share in some of the wild profits that are going on. If you got a CEO at McDonald's making $8.75 million a year, which is about a million hours of work for the person working behind the counter, mm-hmm. I think – and maybe you'll disagree with me, but I think we could probably pay those folks a decent living wage. And you know what? We wouldn't have to pay so much in programs like Medicaid and food stamps. Maybe with the employers to pay their fair share.
Oh, listen, I couldn't agree with you more. Indeed, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot of late, because we've been talking about a change in the minimum wage in this country, that $7.35 doesn't keep you alive. Maybe we ought to have a maximum wage and have the maximum wage that a CEO can earn be related to some crazy multiple about what the average worker in his or her company earns. So that if the average worker at McDonald's is earning $8 an hour, for example, let's cap the CEO's annual salary at, 500 times what the average worker gets? 1,000 times? If it was 1,000 times what the average worker gets, this guy would take a 90% pay cut.
No. But, for me, I look at, again, I go back to this policy tour that the Republicans tell me they're waging because they're looking for poverty and they want to eliminate poverty. And I say the best way to eliminate poverty and to get rid of it is how I got out of poverty.
Yeah.
Give me the opportunity to get a good paying job with benefits and job security and a decent wage so I can support my family and in the process have a contract like every CEO in this country has so that I can have some security in this. But I look at, again, the actions of our Republican friends who are doing this little policy tour right now going after people's ability to organize and actually trying to call organizers stalkers.
No, it's not just calling organizers stalkers, Rick. This is a piece of legislation that they're fiddling with. I think it's called House Bill 1152, if I'm not mistaken. And our listeners should focus on this and write to their House and Senate members about it. This is a law proposed to make union organizing activities conduct that is protected by federal law. Conduct that is protected by no less than the Constitution of the United States of America. Criminal conduct. We're going to treat a union organizer the same way as we treat a convict who is stalking a child or a recalcitrant former spouse that is stalking his former wife. This is not just offensive. this is insane. This is turning our world upside down. And to have it happening at a time when the same people are purporting to have to look for poverty without telling us about what they're going to do when they happen to stumble into it, after they voted for the third budget in a row that cuts the better part of $1 billion in each of those years, nearly $3 billion, from funding education, the real way to eliminate poverty, the way to eliminate poverty that's based in the idea that we train and educate our children so that they qualify for the great jobs that maybe pay $22, $23, $30 an hour and get out of poverty and allow them not only to get out of poverty themselves, but to actually pay taxes and contribute to the tax base to finance some of the fire protection and police protection that we need in an economy that doesn't supply what we must have in the way of jobs and justice. So I'm shocked at this effort on the part of members of the House of Representatives. On the House Judiciary Committee, where Representative Marsico of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is among the principal sponsors of this legislation and is going to conduct a public hearing on it, and engage in this effort to criminalize federally protected conduct. It's shocking to me.
It absolutely is. And it's House Bill 1154 for those who want to make sure that they get the right one when they call their representative.
Thank you. I apologize for giving the wrong number.
And
we're even now. I gave a geography lesson and you gave a legislative lesson.
Yeah. I encourage people to call their representatives, and say, look, you know, at the end of the day, this is bad for us. And because here's what I don't understand. So coworkers, if this passes, coworkers can't talk to each other, but the companies can send out surveillance teams, and that's okay.
Well, the companies can not only send out surveillance teams, but the companies can have a captive audience meeting on company time in the company property and compel every worker to come to the meeting and know who comes and punish up to and including discharge people who choose not to come to a meeting in which the company is telling them why they shouldn't join a union. But if somebody tells them what the benefits of unionization are, that is going to be criminal conduct. If somebody passes out a handbill to notify the public of the failure of an employer to meet minimum area standards for wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, that's going to be criminal stalking, punishable by not merely a fine, but by imprisonment, by taking away our freedom. Because we exercise our federally protected right to organize and bargain collectively, to speak up, to notify the public. And that begs the question of what would happen if somebody perished the thought, put up an inflatable rat.
Oh, can't have that.
You know, that's stalking on steroids, I guess.
But
put them in for life and throw away the key for that one.
Yeah, we don't want anybody drawing attention to anything. But, you know, I look at this, and none of it's surprising to me, Irwin. I mean, I look at the policies that that the Republicans have put forth, and all of it, you know, this poverty tort to me is a sham, because everything that they've done to this point seems to me, and maybe you'll agree or not, seems to make poverty worse. Kicking 41,000 low-wage workers off of adult basic right when the governor took office. Kicking 89,000 kids off a CHIP. Doing away with eliminating the general assistance budget. $3 billion away from education. Not taking the Medicaid expansion money. All of that stuff, to me, makes poverty worse.
Well, they need to find poverty, and it wasn't in their backyards where they live in their fancy homes and drive their fancy cars that we taxpayers pay for. So they figured, I guess, that they had to create some. So they've been working at it really hard for the last 2.5 years, and they've defunded education. They've eliminated adult basic. They've gone through the litany that you just went through, and they did for poverty, I don't know, I guess a gas-guzzling vehicle does for gasoline, okay? They poured gasoline on the poverty flame and then lit it. And it's taken off. It's now a wildfire. And it's directly related to those policies. Those policies that say we want to guarantee through law, through the action of our General Assembly, diminished wages, elimination of works and job security. No health care benefits. We want to make it a law that if you try to speak out and protect yourself from those governmental actions, that we're going to send you to jail. This sounds like 1892 and the Homestead Steel Strike and the Pinkertons coming to take us away.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they'll go so far as to amend the Stand Your Ground law along with this stalking statute so that if an employer feels threatened, they don't have to waste time and have the union organizer get arrested and go to jail. Maybe just shoot them on sight.
Oh, now don't give them any ideas now, Irwin. Come on. But what I find interesting, last week we talked to Representative Wheatley, and he pointed out that, you know, the reality is, you know, when people think of poverty, they think of, you know, urban areas, inner city. The reality is most of the poverty in the state is in rural areas and in the suburbs. Because of the policies of on the federal level during the Bush years and the collapse of 2008 and all of that, it's the suburbs who are being hit hardest by poverty right now, and the same policies that the Republicans have been pushing forth. And there's a chance that maybe, and I'm still hopeful, that some voting people, they wake up.
Well, I'm praying, you're hoping, and they're giving us all the ammunition that we could possibly dream of. President Harry Truman was asked once by a reporter why he always gives everybody hell. And Truman, in Truman-esque form, very rapidly responded by saying to the reporter, "I don't give anybody hell. I tell them the truth, and they think it's hell."
Yep.
And now we have an opportunity to tell the truth about the Stephen Blooms, the truth about so many representatives who are talking one way at home and acting another way here in Harrisburg. And all we need to do is expose it. Somebody wants to know why crime is up? Crime is up because people can't eat, can't feed their kids, can't buy shoes, a new pair of sneakers for the kids to go back to school in 2 weeks. People want to know why the cost of all of our programs, our safety net programs, have gone up. It's because people have to fight and struggle now to qualify for them. And I'm spending as much on litigation over qualification for food stamps, for adult basic kinds of health care coverage, for Medicaid, for access to education, for special ed, for special needs kids, that we don't have money left to actually deliver on the programs.
Yeah.
There's insanity here.
Absolutely.
And it's government-sponsored insanity.
It's the people who tell us that they don't believe in government who are running it into the ground and causing this to happen. It's an absolute shame. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. Got to take a quick break. I appreciate taking the time for us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on the Grand Poverty Tour? Right back after this.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Good fences make good neighbors, goes the old adage. That civilizing thought refers to such friendly structures as the rock fences of New England and whitewashed pickets of the Midwest. But the neighborly adage definitely did not contemplate the 700-mile, 20-foot-high, drone-patrolled, electronically monitored steel and razor wire barricade that our government has erected across our nation's border with Mexico. This thing is not a fence, but a monstrous wall of hostility, a deliberate affront to our Mexican neighbors. As Senator John McCain aptly put it, we have the most militarized border since the fall of the Berlin Wall. There are four big flaws with the theory that you can secure a border by throwing up a big old wall. First, it doesn't work. A 20-foot wall quickly begets 22-foot ladders. People determined to get in or out will find many inventive ways to do it. Second, walls create bigger problems than they resolve, for they are deeply divisive. Our Mexican wall is ugly, both literally and in the unmistakable message of contempt it screams at the Mexican people. It's generating bitterness toward us, and that turns neighbors into enemies. Third, that wall has physically ripped previously united cross-border families, friends, businesses, and cities apart, weakening both sides. Fourth, such walls are insanely expensive. So far, Washington has hurled tens of billions of dollars at this one to build, maintain, and police it, and states have dumped billions more into it. Can these policymakers even spell W-A-S-T-E? Yet, the U.S. Senate recently voted to waste another $46 billion to build 700 more miles of the hateful wall and double the number of militarized border agents. This is Jim Hightower saying, is there no other need in our country for that money? Nothing constructive we might do with it?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So Crew, the group that looks at responsibility and ethics in Washington, they have come out with their list of worst governors. It includes 18, six of whom are the worst of the lot, six others whose conduct raises serious questions about their leadership, and six more who engage some kind of action, suspect. You go down the list, and the ringmasters that their ringmaster level, Nathan Deal of Georgia, Paul LePage of Maine, Bob McDonnell of Virginia, Rick Perry of Texas, Rick Scott of Florida, Scott Walker of Wisconsin. They're the ringmasters. They're the worst of the worst. Then the clowns. And you know whose governor's in with the clowns, don't you? That's right, our governor. Corbett was actually number three in the clown series, behind Stephen Beshear of Kentucky and Jan Brewer of Arizona, but just ahead of Nikki Haley of South Carolina. So I guess we've got some bragging rights there. At least he's ahead of that, and ahead of Susana Martinez of New Mexico and Pat McCrory of North Carolina. The sideshows, Cuomo of New York, Branstad of Iowa, Bobby Jingle Jangle Jindal of Louisiana, Rick Kasich of Ohio, and Rick Snyder of Michigan, all on that list of sideshows. And, they looked at, corruption. They looked at transparency. They looked at partisan politics, which, you look right here in Pennsylvania. We don't know if there's much corruption going on because there's no transparency. And the partisanship in politics, the Democrats have no voice here whatsoever. And I blame that on the voters. You voted these idiots in, and now what you've got is you've got one-party rule, and they can't even do that right. And you look at the cronyism that's going on, the self-enrichment that's going on, the mismanagement, the failure. But they're looking for poverty, Rick. Aren't you happy? They're out there doing their job. Yeah, what I'd like to know, how much is it costing us for them to go on their little listening tour? How much is it costing us as they're gallivanting around the state? Well, they had one meeting, right? The one thing that they've publicized. And what I loved, and you know, I go back to this because it just this whole thing just has me just furious. Because, you know, they, on the 15th, and I didn't really go into this much, and I probably should have spent more on it, but they had this poverty simulation exercise. And we're gonna get somebody to come talk to us about the poverty simulation, where you get to play poverty for an hour. You get to play poor for an hour. You get, and I guess how this whole thing works is you have a month. You got 15 minutes per month or per week to figure out how you're going to pay your bills, how you're going to get to work, how you're going to do things poor people do. So you can put yourself in poor people's shoes. This just, you want to know what it's like to be poor? I can help you. And it's not an hour long simulation. You know, I always mock try the food stamp diet for a week. Try living in poverty for a month and not having all of the resources and all of the connections and all of the networks that people are fortunate enough to be to work through. No, you're on an island, man. You're by yourself. That's what poverty is. And then have to work through a government bureaucracy set up by a bunch of pinheads who thought, wow, those people are just lazy and stupid. So they make these situations so difficult, so onerous, so taxing, so humiliating that you've got to lose all of your self-esteem, all of your self-identity, all of your pride. You lose all of that just so you can feed your kids. And then you're going to tell me you care? It's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, I got an email the other day from someone who said, you know, I like me, they grew up in a poverty environment. And it wasn't the Horatio Alger vision of America that they whittled some bootstraps out of thin air and they pulled themselves up. It's they had help all along the way. It was teachers. It was community activists. It was the faith community. It was a good Samaritan. And, you know, I go through the same thing. It's part of a community. It's we the people. And this nonsensical, ridiculous idea, I did it all alone. I am of such strong moral fortitude that I was able to pull myself. It's nonsense. And what these folks are peddling is a bunch of nonsense. And when Chairman Reed says, well, you know, it's usually just one bad decision. And if we could just fix that one bad decision, you know, then they'd be out of poverty. And I go back to, you know, most people, the bad decision was being born. They chose the wrong door on the way out, I guess. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, RickSmithShow.com. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Just to wrap this up for this hour, you know, I look at this whole push, and look, there's a part of me that really hopes that the Republicans on this listening tour, whatever it is that they're doing, that there's something real in it for them, that this just isn't an exercise to, you know, to placate some of the voters and say, oh, you know, we really care about you, when they really don't. I find it extraordinarily hard to believe that you can be in that position and not know the face of poverty and not know what helps and what makes things worse. I think you make conscious choices when you vote against the minimum wage. I think you make conscious choices when you vote against expanding Medicaid. I think you make conscious choices when you cut budgets for local school districts. I think those choices are made full well knowing that you're making things that much worse. When you vote against living wage ordinances, when you vote against paid sick days, when you vote against all of the things that for the last 30 years the right has been pushing, when you vote for horrible trade policies, when you hand out huge amounts of money to big corporations in tax handouts while taking it from public schools to do it, you got to know what you're doing is making things worse. I mean, you know, just this week we celebrated the 20th anniversary of the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993. One of the things that I give Bill Clinton credit for. One of the things that I'm not thrilled about is that there's no paid component. So right from the beginning, what you've done is you, of the 60% of the workforce who's eligible for it anyway, because you put the number up at 50 employees or more, 40% of the workforce right there gone. But even then, of the 60% that are eligible for it, more than half of them can't do it because they can't afford it. And for me, the party that tells me that they care about family values, the ones who say that they care about the children, oh, they love the children, all of the things that they do. And I remember the family. I'm getting up in years. I remember the fight over the Family Medical Leave Act. And I remember it was those conservative voices. There were Republicans who voted for it, but they weren't the radical conservative type. They were more the Eisenhower type Republican, more the Lincoln type Republican, more the I care about this country, I care about society, I care about families and communities, instead of I only care about myself because it's only about me and about hoarding what we can here at the top, which is where the party has gone. I mean, that's the sad reality, and they've kind of duped us all into thinking, well, you know, we can go with them. We can make it up there if we just worked hard enough, if you just tried enough, if you just put enough elbow grease in it, you could be a billionaire. Here's the reality. And I go back to something my government teacher said years and years and years ago. At the end of the day, Democrats are for big social programs, and the poor Republicans are going to be for the very wealthy and for the very wealthy. You guys in the middle, who, you know, somewhere fluctuate between those, you have to decide where you're closest to. Are you closest to living in poverty, or are you closer to the gated communities that the very well-to-do reside in? And the reality is the vast, vast majority of us are closer to poverty. When you look at the statistics, you know, a good percentage of the population is 2 weeks away from financial distress, a month away from homelessness. When you look at those numbers and you go, okay, you know, why would we want to wish programs away that put a net under our feet? It's because they've done a masterful job of convincing us that, well, you know, it's not going to happen to you. Because you're a producer, you're a hard worker, you're one of the good ones. You just keep going. What 2008, I think, taught people, and I don't know that the lesson's really been learned. What 2008 taught us is that, you know what, none of us are immune. We're all one illness, one job loss, one unfortunate circumstance that Chairman Reid admitted to. We're one mistake, one problem away. Those of us lucky enough to find ourselves in the middle class. The people who were born into poverty, well, it's expensive to be poor. Because you only get the most expensive loans. You only can buy the beater car at the highest interest rates. They charge you the most to cash a check. Good luck getting transportation. Your education is generally less available. And then it's your fault for being poor. You got to love the messaging. And all along, what it is, it's dividing us. It's putting, you know, people who are on the treadmill trying to stay out of poverty against people who are struggling to get on the treadmill. And they got us fighting against each other. We got to stop that. Working people have got to stop fighting each other. And we've got to look at people like Reid and say, you know what, enough of this divisiveness. Get in there and fix it. Expand Medicaid coverage to people in our Commonwealth. Expand the minimum wage. Expand protections on the job. Expand paid sick days. Because it's the right thing to do. And that's how you alleviate poverty. Just that simple. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com or Stitcher on your smartphone. Quick break. Right back with our two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Since 2008, IATSE Local 5 has been putting pressure on the Bank of Kentucky Center at Northern Kentucky University to pay wages comparable to other performing arts centers and arenas in the region. According to IATSE's Tom Gaduli, the center has been bringing in workers from Columbus, Ohio, who they can pay lower wages.
A university put out to bid a contract with this company called SMG. And as such, they lost all of the rights. So the university is not happy with this situation. The Bank of Kentucky, which is actually the naming sponsor, isn't happy with this situation. Our organization, who gives scholarships and recruits students from that university, isn't happy with this situation. And the company that's running it could care less.
Gaduli said IATSE sought to work with the company managing the facility with the understanding that it is a smaller facility with a tighter budget than some of the larger performing arts venues in the area. He said the negotiations broke down with the company deciding it would be simpler to outsource the work.
And in the end, they just felt that it was easier and they could pay people a lot less, travel from Columbus, Ohio, to come into our jurisdiction and take tax dollars away from our local community. This is harmful to our community and our partners, other venues that actually do the right thing in our community.
St. Louis low-wage workers have support from around Missouri for their Can't Survive on 735 campaign. Doug Cunningham reports.
The battles for higher wages and union rights being waged around the country by fast food workers, retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and port workers is part of a dynamic new low-wage worker movement in America. From New York City to St. Louis, from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit, and to L.A. and beyond, workers assisted by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW are standing up for higher wages and the right to form unions. Martine Raffanon is with the St. Louis Workers Organizing Committee in the St. Louis Can't Survive on 735 campaign.
We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So lots of news in the sports world, whether it's baseball or football, which is coming up. You've got concussions. You've got suspensions. You've got drugs. You know, it's all right there. While we don't talk an awful lot about sports when the scandal comes up, well, I guess you got to talk about it. That's why we've asked Travis Waldron, who's been following this stuff over at Think Progress pretty closely. Travis, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do you think? The big drug scandal, A-Rod gone for, what, a year and a quarter, 200 and some games, good, bad, thoughts?
Well, it depends on how you look at it, right? 3 weeks ago we were talking about lifetime bans, and that was probably not a good thing because, as I wrote, we were talking then about just subverting all of the due process and the drug agreement that baseball players and Major League Baseball worked really hard to craft. And I thought that was an overstep by Bud Selig, the commissioner. I still think there's a chance that this is an overstep. There is not a 211-game suspension written out in that drug agreement. Baseball's really trying to make an example out of Alex Rodriguez, and the union and Alex are going to fight that. How it turns out, we won't know for a while, probably not until this winter. But it's going to set a precedent one way or the other for how they deal with drug use and how the drug agreement and the collective bargaining agreement look going forward.
Now, what exactly is he in trouble for? And I know there's this, what is it, Biogenesis is the company that, explain how we got into this mess and how we got here.
So back in January, the Miami New Times, which is an alternative weekly newspaper, God bless them, down in Miami, broke this story of Biogenesis and a federal investigation that was going, sort of a federal raid that was going on. Tony Bosch, this kind of crank doctor, was supplying drugs to a lot of people, anti-aging drugs, including some illegal drugs potentially. And it turns out that he kept notebooks and records of who he was dealing with, and a lot of them were baseball players. 14 enough to, or who received suspensions. And baseball kind of tried their hardest to get into this and figure out what the deal was. They ended up having to kind of cut a deal with Tony Bosch. And the whole process has been a little bit ugly. It hasn't been pretty. It hasn't been fun for either side. And it's, like I said, there's a lot of questions I think that we still have to answer going forward about both about drugs in baseball and about how we're going to deal with people are caught. If this A-Rod suspension holds up, it's a major difference in than how it was supposed to play out theoretically under the drug agreement they agreed to back in 2003.
Yeah, and looking at this, you know, there are some, and I've gotten a number of emails from people who blame, obviously are going to blame the union for this situation. How much blame do you think the union has in this?
Look, I think there's blame to go around, but I think when you look at the fact that in 1994, the Major League Baseball Players Association did not want any part of drug testing. That was Marvin Miller, who was a major influence on the baseball union, obviously, on unions and sports, period, was a staunch opponent of drug testing. And for better or worse, there's arguments on both sides. In 2003, after the steroid era kind of blew up, the Players Association came to the table and said, hey, we're willing to do drug testing. We want to have a clean game. The fans want to have a clean game. I don't think there's a lot of blame for the players' union in this Biogenesis scandal so far. I think the majority of the players accepted their suspensions because they were handled the way they were supposed to be handled under the drug agreement, and they are fighting for Alex Rodriguez. I don't think anyone wants to defend Alex Rodriguez, but you kind of have to. If you think that drug agreement is important, if you think that the bargained agreements that baseball made, whether it's the joint drug agreement or the collective bargaining agreement, are important, then I think you sort of have to at least let A-Rod have his appeals process and find out if this 211-game suspension was warranted or if it's, as Michael Weiner, the head of the union, put it, you know, a massive overreach by the commissioner.
Yeah. What do you say? Now, I had read part of this Mitchell report that was commissioned by Major League Baseball that said half of all the players in Major League Baseball are doing some type of drug. Any talk around that? Because under the guise that it's systemic, it's part of the game.
Well, I think baseball's lying right now, from the players, from Major League Baseball officials, and from the fans. I think most people. The general perception is that baseball is a cleaner game today than it was 10 years ago when the drug agreement was first signed. The problem is and I've written about this too, is I'm not sure we can really know that. You know, I think it probably is. I think baseball is probably cleaner today than it was a decade ago. But Alex Rodriguez, at least on the evidence that is leaked, baseball thinks Alex Rodriguez has been doing steroids since at least 2009. He's never failed a drug test.
Right.
So how many of these guys are passing drug tests? How many of them are taking designer drugs that are getting them through the testing system? I don't know. And I think that's why when Major League Baseball looks at this and says, we need more testing and stronger penalties, I think the real conversation is we need to actually ask ourselves first if the tests are accomplishing the goal that they're supposed to be accomplishing.
And that's the part of it that I've been asking, you know, is all of this testing, is it worth it? I mean, and all of this finger pointing, because I got to be honest, there's part of me that goes, it's part of the game now. It's part of life. I don't know that you get rid of it because everybody's always going to look for that edge, I think.
Look, I think it's delusional for anyone to think that we are going to rid baseball or any other sport of drugs totally. It's just the incentives. The economic incentives are too high when you're talking millions of dollars,
yep.
Separating, you know, big contracts from small contracts. When you're talking about separating minor leagues from major leagues, the incentive to try and beat the system is just too high. And if I just think it's there's always going to be someone who thinks they can beat it. So I think we have to look again and say, how do we reduce it to the minimum? Everyone wants a cleaner game. No one wants every player doing drugs. But if we're not actually, if we have this system in place that we don't actually know if it's accomplishing what it's supposed to do, what are we doing? Because there's a lot of evidence out there that says that drug tests aren't actually a great deterrent for drug use. And we know from other sports that the guys producing the drugs, the people who are producing these performance enhancers, will always be ahead of the people producing the test. You
yep.
can't test for a drug that you don't know exists.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's been my view on it. And I think we just have to come to the reality that it is what it is, and move along. Let's talk about football for a minute. A letter sent to the commissioner, Roger Goodell, on concussions, and the message around that. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, so there were some former players, forget the exact number, that sent a letter to Roger Goodell and said that the league hasn't done enough for veterans, hasn't done enough for the current players, and needs to get better. And a lot of the players, I think 10 of the players who signed the letter, were on the litigation that is going on right now against the NFL. And, you know, to its credit, the league has taken steps in recent years. The problem is that it took so long to take those steps. A lot of these steps were things that should have been done a decade, 2 decades ago, and instead we're just now getting to them. And, you know, we don't know how many brains we wrecked in the process.
Yeah.
And, you know, football has a lot of questions to answer. You know, for all the talk about baseball and steroids, you know, steroids are something that are fairly easy to be dealt with. Concussions, if they are inherent to the game of football, that's a much bigger question than can we reduce drug use. You know, how do you reduce hits to the head in a game like football?
Well, you can't. I mean, myself, in the years that I played for, you know, high school and into college, you know, I'm sure I had at least two. I know of one that I don't remember, but I remember watching myself going, I don't remember that. But, you know, I knew right there was a concussion. I don't think you can do away with them.
Right. Well, and, you know, the thing is Jonathan Mahler, who writes for Bloomberg and Deadspin and a few other places, wrote a column last year, had kind of an incendiary headline on it, said football doesn't have a concussion crisis. And I clicked on it because I was like, wait, you know, is this guy in pure denial? I usually like what he has to say. And he made the point that football's crisis isn't concussions. It's actually existential in that football's problem is football. And we're finding out that it doesn't take concussions to lead to the long-term brain injuries that everybody's afraid of. The accumulation of the routine hits to the head can actually be just as dangerous.
Sure, look at boxing.
Right, and if that's the case, then it's a much different problem. You know, there's a lot of rule changes, there's a lot of treatments, a lot of things you can do to reduce concussions, to make the game safer. But, you know, if routine tackling and routine blocking and just routinely playing the game of football is dangerous, well, Your fix here just got a whole lot harder to find.
Yeah. I mean, you look at boxers. I for a while when I was a young man, I dabbled in boxing a little bit. And I remember some of the old timers who, you know, they just said they were punch drunk. But, you know, it was, the reality is they really were. Their brains were basically mush. They couldn't string a sentence together, half of them.
Right. And that's the question, you know, whether it's in old age or whether it's these guys now that you come off the field. I mean, we've all heard the phrase, you know, he got his bell rung. Well, you know, that's a much more serious problem than we thought it was 5, 10, 15 years ago. Well, when a guy gets his bell rung, he probably shouldn't get back on the field any time, at least that day. And, you know, again, if it doesn't even take getting your bell rung to really jeopardize yourself, you know, we have to have a really deep discussion about how to go forward. And look, football is always going to be a dangerous game. At least no one who's reasonably entered in this conversation wants to just, like, abolish the game of football, other than Malcolm Gladwell. But, you know, we do have to have a really serious discussion about how this game goes forward. And the pros are one thing. But when you have the NCAA engaging in a cover-up of concussions and not really taking any action, and when you have high school federations and associations that are just now taking action, those are the ones we have to really worry about.
I'm with you. You wrote a piece recently that caught my attention, you know, about legislation on the college level that would mandate concussion testing. And I'm going, they don't already do that?
No. So the NCAA, I mean, if you think the NFL has been bad, the NFL looks like they did everything they possibly could compared to the NCAA. This court case against the NCAA, this federal court case, where they just unsealed a bunch of the records a few weeks ago. And at one point, there was federal legislation about concussion management. It never went anywhere because it's federal legislation. But somebody from the NCAA official comes to the NCAA medical director and asks him, are these standards going to go above and beyond what we have? Because that would look bad. And the medical director says, well, of course they are. We don't have any standards. Wow. And even now, the NCAA mandates that all schools, all member schools, have what is called a concussion management plan, which is great, except that there's no oversight. They require schools to submit it to them, but there's no enforcement measures if schools don't. There's no monitoring to figure out if schools are actually following their plans. So what you get is you get a guy like Robert Woods, a wide receiver from Southern California last year, who gets laid out on a play, pretty obviously was knocked out, gets up, goes to the wrong sideline, and 10 minutes later is back on the field. And you have to ask yourself, was he evaluated the right way? Was he looked at? Maybe he was. But, it raises questions. Yeah. And it makes you wonder why it's not standard across the league, across the NCAA.
And it makes you wonder, I had read in one of your pieces that currently, and I guess it's not mandated, but only 66% of schools have baseline testing, I guess according to the 2010 survey. But, you would think that all of them would track some of that on some level. But I guess it costs too much money, and at the end of the day, to me, the NCAA is all about the money. It's not about the student-athlete.
Right, so there's two points there. I mean, baseline testing doesn't really cost that much money. You basically sit the kids down at the beginning of the year. You ask them basic cognitive questions so you can figure out what they're like when they're normal. Then if you suspect them of suffering a head injury, you do that exact same test, and then you compare the results. And it doesn't diagnose a concussion, but it gives a trainer or a doctor a whole lot of information to figure out if there might be a concussion. And on the other point is the NCAA being all about the money. If you really look into this lawsuit, one of the big reasons why the NCAA never standardized rules was because of legal liability. They thought, hey, if we don't have rules, if we make the schools have the rules, then we can say, oh, well, it was the school's fault when these kids get hurt,
yeah,
or when they don't get treated right.
You know, the thing is I coached my fifth grader. I coached her in basketball when she was fourth and fifth grade, and I'll coach again this year. But I had to take a class on concussions, and there was a reporting process. And then we're talking at the elementary school level where there's a process in place. So I'm thinking if it's down here, and it's pretty stringent. I mean, you have to report every head injury, and you have to – there's a whole process that goes along with this as an elementary school coach. I'm thinking, well, it's got to be at the high school and college level, but surprisingly, I'm finding none of that. Also, another piece you wrote that I thought catastrophic care was part of the insurance plans that high school athletes get. Evidently not.
No. It's actually, I looked all around for this, and I haven't had time to make the phone calls and figure out the exact answer, but how prevalent it is to not have that. But Illinois passed the legislation last week to mandate it, and it's, again, money-wise, $5 per high school athlete in Illinois schools, and the schools are going to cover that cost. I mean, that's ridiculously cheap when you consider that, you're one kid who breaks his neck, and there's one in every 100,000 high school athletes every year suffers a spinal cord injury. Well, I think that's only regulated to football.
Right.
One in 100,000. So it's not a totally uncommon occurrence.
That's a huge number.
And that can leave you with, the kid who was hurt in Illinois that they named this law for a decade ago had $5 million in medical bills.
Wow.
Before he ran out of money that he received from donations and from a policy that his school actually had. We're talking when you have a spinal cord injury that leaves you as a quadriplegic, that's millions of dollars of medical bills.
Yeah, and all of the stuff that comes along with it, the vans, the retrofitting of the house, all of the stuff,
right,
that most of those plans don't cover. It's and I always thought there was something there that evidently not. And good on Illinois. Maybe it's something we got to look at here in Pennsylvania. Travis, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time and appreciate the reporting that you do on these issues.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Travis. Talk to you again real soon. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Good fences make good neighbors, goes the old adage. That civilizing thought refers to such friendly structures as the rock fences of New England and whitewashed pickets of the Midwest. But the neighborly adage definitely did not contemplate the 700-mile, 20-foot-high, drone-patrolled, electronically monitored steel and razor wire barricade that our government has erected across our nation's border with Mexico. This thing is not a fence, but a monstrous wall of hostility, a deliberate affront to our Mexican neighbors. As Senator John McCain aptly put it, we have the most militarized border since the fall of the Berlin Wall. There are 4 big flaws with the theory that you can secure a border by throwing up a big old wall. First, it doesn't work. A 20-foot wall quickly begets 22-foot ladders. People determined to get in or out will find many inventive ways to do it. Second, walls create bigger problems than they resolve, for they are deeply divisive. Our Mexican wall is ugly, both literally and in the unmistakable message of contempt it screams at the Mexican people. It's generating bitterness toward us, and that turns neighbors into enemies. Third, that wall has physically ripped previously united cross-border families, friends, businesses, and cities apart, weakening both sides. Fourth, such walls are insanely expensive. So far, Washington has hurled tens of billions of dollars at this one to build, maintain, and police it, and states have dumped billions more into it. Can these policymakers even spell W-A-S-T-E? Yet, the U.S. Senate recently voted to waste another $46 billion to build 700 more miles of the hateful wall and double the number of militarized border agents. This is Jim Hightower saying, is there no other need in our country for that money? Nothing constructive we might do with it?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, more on the privatization front. The ISAs of the world pushing to destroy the Postal Service. Well, two senators, one a Democrat, one a Republican, Tom Carper of Delaware, Democrat Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, Republican, have introduced a piece of legislation in the Senate that they claim will save the Postal Service from the financial collapse that they created. Understand, they're the only entity in this country, I think in civilization, that's ever had to pre-fund their employee health benefits 75 years into the future. Nobody else has it. No other institute, nothing. Nobody has it. And without that mandate, they would have made about $1.5 billion. Now, instead, well, they're billions of dollars in the red. So you've got Carper and Coburn now saying, well, you know, we'll get rid of that. And, well, we'll make it not mandatory, but we're going to set the parameters so that maybe down the road you can get rid of Saturday delivery. And, you know, maybe, you know, down the road, get rid of, you know, door-to-door service, you know, but down the road, you know, that's not right now. So what it basically is it's a lesser ISA bill. Okay, we're gonna do away what we should just do away with. But in exchange for doing away with what we should have never passed, we're gonna put this insanity in it. Understand what they're saying they're going to do. Because they poison pilled the post office. This is the Republicans doing. Back in 2006, they passed a law saying that the Postal Service had to pre-fund their employee health care 75 years into the future. Here's the side note to this. Had we a national health care system, if Obamacare is implemented and we have a national health care system and people can get it, this is a moot point. Because the Postal Service is putting billions of dollars into this fund. Because the law said they had to. My view on it is they were forced to do it so they wouldn't be reinvesting in their business so that they would be a little weaker and a little bit less resourced. And, of course, put in a position where they can be easily destroyed. So you've got this mandate, this poison pill that the Republicans rammed down their throat. You throw on top of it their cure, which is modernized, which means closing distribution facilities, which means slowing down the process of getting mail from one place to another, which means first-class mail takes an extra day, second-class mail probably 2 to 3 days extra, which means people are going to go, well, you know, if it's going to take me a week to get a letter now across the country, I won't send it. Now what you're doing is you're handcuffing the post office. And then you start saying, well, we're going to do away with Saturday delivery. And then down the road, well, we're going to go to 4 days a week. And, oh, well, then, like the newspapers, just 3 days a week. Or, oh, no more home delivery. You'll have to go to the post office or a cluster box at a Walmart. And, oh, if you want home delivery, you can pay for it. Listen to what they're doing to the Postal Service, something that is profitable if you just get rid of this insane mandate. But that's not what the right wants. And the thing that gets me is you've got some Democrats who go, well, we've got to figure out how to save the post office. And Carper's, you know, signed on to this. Well, you know, this seems a reasonable compromise. There's no compromise. And I wish Democrats would stop. You go, okay, well, you know, we're going to kill you. Okay, well, can we compromise on that? How about you just cut off both my legs? You still get your pound of flesh, but I'm still not dead, right? Oh, okay, we'll cut off both your legs. That's kind of what you're doing here to the Postal Service. Well, we're not going to kill you right now, but we'll just chop off your legs. And no medical care, because obviously you can't afford it. So you'll bleed to death. But, you know, we didn't kill you. The bleeding did. This is what's going on. And I wish Democrats would go, no, whoa, 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 whoa. You guys screwed this up. You guys poison-pilled this thing. It's been your wet dream from the 80s to privatize the Postal Service. We know privatization doesn't work. We know it's a ripoff. We know it's a scam. We know the public never gets the service. The price never comes down. We know that. We've learned it time and time and time again. So why is it that you still hear dim-witted puddle brain flag monkeys going, oh, we need to privatize the post office? Idiotic. When will we learn? Show me, and I challenge anyone, show me one thing we've privatized that it's actually worked out better for you and me and we the people. I can show you things that we've privatized that have worked well for the very handful. They've profitized very well. I mean, they've lined their pockets at, of course, your expense and mine. Same thing's going to happen here with the Postal Service. Mark my word. If they get this through, if they get this next poison pill, this next bit of poisonous medicine down our throat, it's done. Mission accomplished. Break out the Bush banner. Break out the sock for the drawers. All of that. It's over. Pretty simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Since 2008, IATSE Local 5 has been putting pressure on the Bank of Kentucky Center at Northern Kentucky University to pay wages comparable to other performing arts centers and arenas in the region. According to IATSE's Tom Gadooley, the center has been bringing in workers from Columbus, Ohio, who they can pay lower wages.
A university put out to bid a contract with this company called SMG, and as such, they lost all of the rights. So the university is not happy with this situation. The Bank of Kentucky, which is actually the naming sponsor, isn't happy with this situation. Our organization, who gives scholarships and recruits students from that university, isn't happy with this situation. And the company that's running it could care less.
Gadooley said IATSE sought to work with the company managing the facility with the understanding that it is a smaller facility with a tighter budget than some of the larger performing arts venues in the area. He said the negotiations broke down with the company deciding it would be simpler to outsource the work.
And in the end, they just felt that it was easier and they could pay people a lot less, travel from Columbus, Ohio, to come into our jurisdiction and take tax dollars away from our local community. This is harmful to our community and our partners, other venues that actually do the right thing in our community.
St. Louis low-wage workers have support from around Missouri for their Can't Survive on 735 campaign. Doug Cunningham reports.
The battles for higher wages and union rights being waged around the country by fast food workers, retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and port workers is part of a dynamic new low-wage worker movement in America. From New York City to St. Louis, from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit, and to L.A. and beyond, workers assisted by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW are standing up for higher wages and the right to form unions. Martine Raffanon is with the St. Louis Workers Organizing Committee and the St. Louis Can't Survive on 735 campaign.
We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the big news this week has been the sale of the Washington Post to the guy who owns Amazon. So, you know, like on Tuesday, you had President Obama going to visit the Amazon thing in Tennessee. I guess it was last week, actually. Went out to visit the Amazon facility there in Tennessee, and now Amazon's bought the Washington Post. I guess a good week for Amazon, but here to help us work through what this purchase means, not only for the Post, but for the former owner of the Post, it's David Halpern. He's a lawyer and a writer over at the Republic Report. He's written a piece, Bezos Purchase of the Post Leaves Graham with Kaplan for Profit College. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, Rick. Glad to be on.
You know, here again, you know, you look at these for-profit colleges, and I honestly didn't know that that the Post owned Kaplan. I guess it shows how much I've been paying attention to the Post.
Well, in fact, the Post pays attention to Kaplan since it provided last year 55% of the revenues for the company. Now, that includes the Stanley Kaplan testing service that a lot of your readers might have used to try to boost their SAT score or other tests they might have taken. But large part of it is this Kaplan for-profit college. A for-profit college, as you know, is a college, but it's one that depends almost entirely on federal money to fund it. Kaplan receives almost 90% of its revenue from taxpayers, which would be okay, I guess, if they're doing a great job educating students. But unfortunately, their record is very, very poor. It's a terrible record, and it's among the worst of for-profit colleges. They mislead students, lots of evidence of that. They charge very high tuition. They have a 70% dropout rate, and many, many of their students, like almost two-thirds, are unable to pay back their loans because they don't earn enough money to pay the enormous amount of money that pay back the enormous amount of money they borrowed.
You know, what I've always wondered is why people even get involved with these schools, these online schools, because their reputations, at least in my world, are horrible. I mean, you look at the University of Phoenix, the Kaplan's, the Strayers, and I don't know if you saw the recent Strayer University ad where they'll start a graduation fund. They'll give you 25% of your money back if you graduate. And I just did the quick math. They'll give you $17,750 if you graduate. But a degree from there is $71,000 for an online at-home degree. To me, that's almost a crime.
Well, they aren't all online, but often they are poor quality and often they are overpriced. Kaplan had a nursing program which was not online, was in person in Charlotte, North Carolina. They told students if they took a dental assistant program, excuse me, that if they took the program, they'd be able to get a certain kind of dental assistant job. Well, they lied to them. And in the end of the program, it turned out they couldn't get the kind of job, the certificate that they thought they were going to get. So in that case, they were caught, and they gave the money back. There's Concord Law School, also part of Kaplan. Many students don't know after they sign up or even sometimes after they graduate that it's unaccredited, and they can't even sit for the bar exam except in one state out of 50. So there's lots of this sort of misleading stuff going on, low quality of instruction. Not every instructor is bad, and not every for-profit college is bad. But Kaplan is a bad one, and another one, Corinthian College, which may be the worst of the big for-profit colleges. The Washington Post Company actually also owns about 8% or 6.5% of Corinthian colleges. So a lot of the money that went into the Washington Post Company was coming from these for-profit colleges. But really the thing that makes me the most incensed about the situation is that Don Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post and the son of Katherine Graham, who's considered a great hero in journalism, basically used his prestige as a powerful, successful, ethical person in Washington, a seemingly ethical person, to be essentially the chief lobbyist for for-profit colleges when President Obama's administration said, we have to do something about these schools. President Obama wanted to have a rule that said basically if two-thirds of your students were unable to pay back their loans, then maybe you shouldn't be getting federal aid because you're not doing a good job. It was Don Graham who went in and lobbied against that because he knew the people in the White House. He knew the senators. He went to think tanks, including the think tank I worked at, the Center for American Progress, to lobby on this. And he put his prestige behind this, and he said, we're the only ones who are helping out low-income students. We're giving them a chance by enrolling them. Well, enrolling a student doesn't do them any good.
Right.
If you're just banking their checks, their own money and the government's money. What's good is if you educate them, and there's lots of evidence that Kaplan was not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the amount of money that some of these cost, and I don't know how you can claim you're helping low-income students.
I mean, some of the schools do, and some people have a good experience, but the record shows that Kaplan often does very poorly by these students. And, again, they're doing it at taxpayer expense, 90% of their revenue from taxpayers.
And what is the graduation rate there? Are there any studies on that? Because, you know, when I saw the
Strayer. The dropout rate is 70% for Kaplan, which is of the 10 schools that are the top 10 recipients of GI Bill money, so they're educating our veterans, Kaplan had the highest dropout rate.
Wow. How high was it?
70%.
Wow. So only 30% of the people. I wonder about this Strayer thing, because I caught this Strayer thing. I don't know if you know Strayer University.
Sure.
They're one of the big ones. But they've got this, like I said, this 25% graduation fund. And my first thought was, are you just not graduating anyone and you're trying to incentivize people to stay in the program and keep funneling you money? Or what's the deal here? Because I can't imagine you're going to give back a quarter of what it is you're bringing in for people to graduate if people are already doing that.
Well, I don't know what all the catches on that one are, but quite a few don't graduate. And again, the price is so high. It's much cheaper to go to a community college for an associate's degree or a state university. These colleges cost almost as much as Harvard, but they don't have anywhere near the guarantee of success. And, you know, it is a tough thing for people out there trying to decide where to go to school because they're struggling. They want to do something right by their family. So they see these ads on TV. All these schools have huge boiler room operations of recruiting. And what students are referred to in those boiler rooms are pieces of business and also asses in classes. The whole structure of these schools is sign up as many people as you can, and the consequences for the students and the taxpayers be damned. And we know this is going on. This is something that I and a large coalition of labor and civil rights and student and other groups have been pushing hard to create some reforms. Not to say you can't have a for-profit college. There's nothing wrong with trying that. But that if you're going to have a school, if you're going to get financial aid, if you're going to be educating our veterans, you better be producing results. You better take seriously the idea this is education and not a scam. And the idea that Don Graham, pillar of the Washington establishment, was out there basically being the leader of an effort to avoid accountability to solve this problem, I find outrageous. And in addition, here's some of the ways that it distorted the Washington Post. Kaplan was a member of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, responsible for all kinds of bad anti-labor, anti-environment things, but also the voter ID laws, which are making it harder for people to vote, young people, old people, people of color, low-income people. ALEC was pushing that law, and Kaplan was a member of ALEC that was pushing it. ALEC also pushed the Stand Your Ground law, famous from the Trayvon Martin case. Right. So the Washington Post was out there covering ALEC and covering these controversies and never disclosed. I was the one who actually first reported it, that the Washington Post through Kaplan was a member of ALEC. In addition, their previous CEO of Kaplan, when he left in 2008, was given a golden parachute severance package. He got $76 million. Last year, when Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland asked the for-profit colleges to tell how much their CEOs were getting paid, Kaplan refused. They said, we don't have to disclose that to the Securities Exchange Commission, so we're not going to disclose it to you. Even though 90% of the money is from taxpayers, and even though the Washington Post, which is, you know, part of Kaplan, part of the same company, obviously spends a lot of time trying to root out corruption, especially corruption at taxpayer expense, they would not tell how much their CEO is being paid.
Interesting.
That is what the Washington Post has become as it's been distorted by its, you know, heavy dependence on Kaplan.
So let me ask you, I mean, in looking at the reporting on this then, is there anything there that maybe the reporting was favorable to Kaplan, maybe it was favorable to the for-profit colleges? Is there anything in the Post's past that would say that, you know, it was in the tank for the for-profit industry?
Yeah. Their editorials favored the for-profit colleges and opposed reform. During the run-up to the fight, to the conclusion of the fight about President Obama's reform, the Post's coverage was vague. It didn't always mention the connection, and there was finally this long sort of tortured piece about how the Post got into Kaplan, but it was not particularly critical of Kaplan itself. And so I do think that the ownership of it affected the coverage. I also wrote to the ombudsman, particularly they had Bill Gates, the CEO of Kaplan, wrote a book about education, and it was all about, you know, higher education, here's how we should educate our children. He was critical of traditional higher education. And I said the book made a lot, I wrote an article, I said the book made a lot of good points, but it was like a book on energy policy by Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons. You know, someone who really is not a very positive actor in the sector that kind of makes the person's views just a little bit less valid. So to review the book in the Post, they got Bill Gates, who said it was a wonderful book about education, without mentioning that Bill Gates' wife sat on the board of the Washington Post Company, and that the Gates Foundation, much of its money comes from Warren Buffett, who owns a good chunk of the Washington Post Company. So there's a lot of conflicts of interest. I was complaining to the Post ombudsman at the time, Patrick Pexton, that I thought that the Post was not disclosing its conflicts and was not handling things fairly. I mentioned this in the article that I wrote that's on Republic Report and also on Huffington Post about this. And Pexton finally wrote me back after a bunch of times, and I wrote to him, and he said, I plan to write something soon, or I hope to write something soon about Kaplan. He never did. He left, and the position of ombudsman was abolished at the Washington Post. So I do think it, you know, there, I know that reporters there told me that they were upset about Kaplan itself and also how the paper was dealing with it. And the end of my article says, now there's a lot of terrific journalists at the Post, and now that this rotten core of the company has been severed, maybe the Post will actually do better. I have no idea about how Bezos, you know, will handle the Post. I actually think it's potentially a promising thing compared to the alternative, but I also think it's interesting that Donald Graham, who really stuck his neck out for Kaplan, is now left with a company that is even more dominated by Kaplan and by their stake in Corinthian colleges. And I think, you know, Graham in some ways seems like a wonderful person. You know, he went to Vietnam and fought when his family could have gotten him out of it probably, and he was a police officer in D.C. He's much beloved in the newsroom there, and I'm sure he did great things for the paper, but I really do think that he kind of lost his way in making Kaplan such a big part of the company. It would have been better off, frankly, you know, if someone could say, well, it did finance a wonderful newspaper, it helped. It would have been better to just have taxpayers fund the Post directly than have it funded through this college that has ruined so many students' lives in the process.
Which I've got to be honest with, I'm not absolutely opposed to having news organizations funded by taxpayer dollars. Maybe then we would get some honest news.
Well, but, you know, the counter to that would be, of course, that if journalism is dependent on government money, it can be corrupted by government money and become an organ of the state. So it's a very tough, you know, to figure out whether you want your journalism dependent on government or dependent on corporations. What you really want it dependent on is wonderful working people, but they don't have the capital. And, of course, that's the good thing about the Internet. I was doing another show tonight, and I said, you know, the good thing is anyone with a good story has a chance to break through. Yes, you know, things that are more heavily promoted are going to have a better chance. But if you really have something new on the Internet, it can break through, and that is a great equalizer and a great, you know, thing for our democracy.
So last question I've got for you, then, and it's back to the Post, because you know, I would have to imagine that there's some people very happy about this sale and moving forward and being out from under this weight of Kaplan. But, you know, I guess I don't know, looking at Amazon, if that's a much better situation.
Well, I mean, Bezos bought the Post himself for $250 million, so it's not actually being bought by Amazon. But, yeah, he is Amazon. And, you know, there is the potential for him trying to figure out how to make a newspaper truly work in the Internet age and make money. But the question is, can you do it without corrupting what we all love about newspapers and care about newspapers, that they're truly independent, that they're investigative, that they don't get co-opted? I mean, so much of Washington now is, you know, journalistic outlets like Politico and the Atlantic Monthly and even the Chronicle of Higher Education. They make money by doing events sponsored by the very corporations that they are supposed to be covering.
Right.
And those events basically get corrupted and slanted and distorted by those kind of relationships. The buying of Washington is not just about politicians. It's about buying think tanks. It's about buying journalism. It's about buying anything you can imagine that could be bought. And so that would be another concern about yet another capitalist getting into a business, but newspapers are a business. So if we're going to have large-scale journalism with resources, somebody with money's got to buy it. And so you just got to hope there's some beneficence. And you did see it from the Graham family for a while, but once the Internet made the newspaper model more challenging, then you get something like a newspaper owned by a conglomerate that is largely dominated by a corrupt for-profit college.
Yeah, my concern is now is you're never going to see a story on misclassified workers or temp workers or employers not covering health care. I think the employment side of things are gonna, not that you see them all that often now, but I don't think you'll ever see it at this point forward.
I totally agree. I mean, they're very strong. Their labor policies are not progressive. And he may well say now, gee, I'm happy to let the paper be independent. And then someone's going to call him up and say, you know, Jeff, everyone down at the high tech club is upset that you have this whole series on, you know, the struggles of workers at various high tech companies. And he may make a phone call. Let's hope he doesn't.
Yeah. The report is Bezos' purchase of the Post leaves Graham with Kaplan for profit college, written by David Halperin over at the Republic Report. We've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on David's name. It'll take you right there. David, it's great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Thanks so much. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening.
Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Good fences make good neighbors, goes the old adage. That civilizing thought refers to such friendly structures as the rock fences of New England and whitewashed pickets of the Midwest. But the neighborly adage definitely did not contemplate the 700-mile, 20-foot-high, drone-patrolled, electronically monitored steel and razor wire barricade that our government has erected across our nation's border with Mexico. This thing is not a fence, but a monstrous wall of hostility, a deliberate affront to our Mexican neighbors. As Senator John McCain aptly put it, we have the most militarized border since the fall of the Berlin Wall. There are 4 big flaws with the theory that you can secure a border by throwing up a big old wall. First, it doesn't work. A 20-foot wall quickly begets 22-foot ladders. People determined to get in or out will find many inventive ways to do it. Second, walls create bigger problems than they resolve, for they are deeply divisive. Our Mexican wall is ugly, both literally and in the unmistakable message of contempt it screams at the Mexican people. It's generating bitterness toward us, and that turns neighbors into enemies. Third, that wall has physically ripped previously united cross-border families, friends, businesses, and cities apart, weakening both sides. Fourth, such walls are insanely expensive. So far, Washington has hurled tens of billions of dollars at this one to build, maintain, and police it, and states have dumped billions more into it. Can these policymakers even spell W-A-S-T-E? Yet, the U.S. Senate recently voted to waste another $46 billion to build 700 more miles of the hateful wall and double the number of militarized border agents. This is Jim Hightower saying, is there no other need in our country for that money? Nothing constructive we might do with it?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, here's one of those things where you go, heroes. Yeah, we love heroes. We love putting them up on pedestals. We love taking pictures of them. We love saying how wonderful they are, patting them on the back. Yes, we love our heroes, right? Times are tough. Things are going crazy. You know, these people rushing into a building that's collapsing. Yeah, we love them. Take the pictures with them. But when they get sick, not so much. We love the soldiers. Yes, yes, till they get sick, post-PTSD. Well, got to take care of them. Not so much. Firefighters. Oh, love firefighters, especially in uniforms, running into the buildings, into the fires, until something goes wrong. And I look at the fire in Arizona. Not too long ago, that killed 19 firefighters. It was back June 30th, actually. 19 people, 19 of the 20, the hotshot crew, burnt to death. One of the firefighters who died in the fire, his wife went to the city and said, you know, my husband was a full-time employee. He worked for you full-time. We were told that, you know, we would get, you know, benefits that would help, you know, for the children. We'd get some compensation, stuff like that. the response from the city official, according to Julianne Ashcraft, is the response that this woman got was, perhaps there was a communication issue in your marriage. Because, no, you don't get it, because your husband wasn't full-time. See, he was seasonal. He was a part-time, even though he was working 40 hours a week, every week, all year long. He was seasonal, you know, because now seasonal goes from January 1st to December 31st. That's a seasonal employee, according to the city officials there in Arizona. And what's interesting is this is someone that we call a hero. And this is how we, and it's not just this instance, it's almost all of them universally. I go back to 9/11, you know, we Bush with the pictures and, you know, oh, we love the people working there. But man, when they started getting sick, how many years did it take to get some measure of health care for folks? And I look at this being the same thing. Now, I understand that, you know, if you're a full-time employee there in this situation, you'd gotten about, I think, a federal payment in excess of $300,000. You'd have gotten some workers' compensation, some health care benefits, some funding for a while. I guess none of that now since you were a seasonal employee. And to me, it takes me back to this position that our labor laws are broken. That we've allowed too many loopholes. Because according to the city, they say they've fully complied with all laws and employment policies that direct survivor benefits. And here's the thing. I mean, if this is what we're doing in the public sector, this is what we, the people, have chosen to do, what do you think they do in the private sector? Which is why you're seeing the whole push towards privatizing all of this stuff. And the question I guess I have is this the country that we want? And if this is how we treat the people we call heroes, who's going to be the next generation of heroes? Who's going to be the person who's willing to step forward and say, I'm next? I mean, that's my question. It's one of those things that makes you kind of wonder, is this the right way to go? And I don't think so. You know, if you're going to take the photo up, you're going to take the picture, you got to back it up with the responsibility. And if I remember going back to when we started into Iraq and Afghanistan, the first thing I said is, you know, my views on it one way or another aren't as important as whatever happens to the people that we're sending into harm's way, that we take responsibility and we take care of them. Because I saw those guys coming back from Vietnam as a kid, and I never wanted to see that again. Anyway, I'll take a quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Since 2008, IATSE Local 5 has been putting pressure on the Bank of Kentucky Center at Northern Kentucky University to pay wages comparable to other performing arts centers and arenas in the region. According to IATSE's Tom Gaduli, the center has been bringing in workers from Columbus, Ohio, who they can pay lower wages.
A university put out to bid a contract with this company called SMG, and as such, they lost all of the rights. So the university is not happy with this situation. The Bank of Kentucky, which is actually the naming sponsor, isn't happy with this situation. Our organization, who gives scholarships and recruits students from that university, isn't happy with this situation. And the company that's running it could care less.
Gaduli said IATSE sought to work with the company managing the facility with the understanding that it is a smaller facility with a tighter budget than some of the larger performing arts venues in the area. He said the negotiations broke down with the company deciding it would be simpler to outsource the work.
And in the end, they just felt that it was easier and they could pay people a lot less to travel from Columbus, Ohio, to come into our jurisdiction and take tax dollars away from our local community. This is harmful to our community and our partners, other venues that actually do the right thing in our community.
St. Louis low-wage workers have support from around Missouri for their Can't Survive on 735 campaign. Doug Cunningham reports.
The battles for higher wages and union rights being waged around the country by fast food workers, retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and port workers is part of a dynamic new low-wage worker movement in America. From New York City to St. Louis, from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit and to L.A. and beyond, workers assisted by unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and UFCW are standing up for higher wages and the right to form unions. Martine Raffanon is with the St. Louis Workers Organizing Committee and the St. Louis Can't Survive on 735 campaign.
We've got home care workers. We've got workers in retail. These workers need to change the context of these jobs, make them strong middle-class jobs. That's our work. That's our goal. This movement resonates so broadly across our community in terms of both workers and those who stand with workers in St. Louis and then across the nation. These workers are leading the charge, but this is a fight for all of us. There's a coalition of unions that are working to support this effort in Missouri, in St. Louis, and also we have a tremendous infrastructure for support of these workers through Missouri Jobs with Justice.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the Discord Gate.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So today in Chicago, the ALEC group, the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, the people who brought us the Stand Your Ground laws, the people who brought us the model legislation for voter suppression, the people who brought us tons of this anti-worker, anti-rights legislation, all this model stuff, you know, like the woman in Florida who didn't even bother to take their name off of the model legislation, just introduced it as her own. I used to have a word for that when I was in school. What was that called? Oh, yeah, plagiarism. Yeah, and actually, no, that was just plain theft. That was something that would get you thrown up. But evidently down in the Florida legislature, that gets you a pat on the back and maybe a special gold-plated invitation to the 40th annual ALEC meeting that was held today in Chicago. But they were met by a number of protesters and people who said, you know, we're really not thrilled that you're here. And here to help us talk about the 40th annual meeting and what ALEC means to the country is Scott Fovell. He is the regional political coordinator for People for the American Way. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thank you.
So the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, the folks who brought us all of that wonderful legislation, all of that pro-corporate stuff that has made the economic divide in our nation the widest since the Great Depression, and probably even wider than that, they're back at it, I guess.
Yeah, the 1% of the 1% are pushing their agenda again here in Chicago. And, you know, really what we're talking about, Rick, is we're talking about a bunch of corporations feeling that they need to have the same rights as the legislators who belong to this organization. And, you know, for 40 years they've been influencing legislation and have really crowed about their success in doing it and funneling money to these legislators. Tonight we actually had a chance to watch as a group Bill Moyer's latest special on this called The United States of ALEC. And it's kind of a setup piece for our activists who are going to be protesting tomorrow at noon in front of the Palmer House Hilton here in Chicago.
You know, I look at this, and with all of the exposure, all of the waking up that people have had to what ALEC has done and what it means to the country, I'm surprised that they're, one, still in existence, because, I mean, when the right went after ACORN, they eventually folded. I guess it shows to me the power of the wealth class in this country because, you know, the left would have said, okay, fine, this is a lost cause. Let's start something else or go somewhere else. But, you know, the wealth class of this country, man, they've really, while companies have left, they're still funded. They're still moving forward with their model legislation.
Well, that's really true, Rick. And, you know, if you look at the agenda that Alec is pushing now, really kind of comes down to three core things, fracking, virtual schools, and privatization. And there's actually a report that's going to be launched early tomorrow morning by Center for Media and Democracy and a group of their partners detailing Alec's latest agenda, which includes support for bounty hunters like they've done in Wisconsin, support for more fracking, more energy exploitation, giving workers less for working at lower wage jobs, a whole swath of legislation state to state to state that does more for the 1% and less for the 99%, and in fact actively disenfranchises the 99%.
And what gets me is, you know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, we've got, from what I understand, some 40 legislators who are still members of ALEC that I don't think that the mass of the public knows are even members of this. And I'm sure that, and I wish there were someone there to pick out our representative, take pictures going in and out, because someone's got to expose these people and hold them accountable at the ballot box.
Well, hopefully I will run into Senator Pileggi while I'm here. And the other members of the Pennsylvania delegation. We actually have spent some time working in Pennsylvania on this issue and identifying who the members of ALEC are. And one of the things that we are going to do is try to track members who are here who, you know, well, you're out of session in Pennsylvania and they're in Chicago. We know why they're here. So we're doing a lot more work than just the protests. We're going to be doing some tracking. We're going to be finding out exactly what's going on in these meetings because ALEC has one thing in common. They want to influence everybody. So we actually we have some friends in the ALEC meetings as well that are going to tell us exactly what they're doing. And our hope is that we can bring that back to people in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, where I'm from, and here in Illinois, where they're really executing a lot of influence. And exposing them across the board.
I mean, the mastery of what ALEC has been. And ALEC's been around since, I guess, what, 1973 they started?
40 years, right.
They've been around this, you know, this whole time. And the mastery of it is at the state level where, you know, there's a lot of influence at the federal level, but they've really taken it to the local state levels and influenced in big ways this, you know, policy that goes through and have such influence. I mean, you look at the stand your ground things, you look at the voter suppression things, you look at all of this stuff that has cost taxpayers millions and millions of dollars, and, by the way, taken some of our rights away as well, all in the pursuit of more.
And really, they've affected us from top to bottom, Rick. You know, one of the big things that I like to focus on is education and public education specifically. The privatization movement across all areas of city government, this is what they're about. So city, state government, local government, they want to privatize everything they possibly can and bring that taxpayer money into their corporate coffers to help their bottom line, their profits, their investors. And that's really their overall goal in influencing all these legislators state to state to state. It used to be that ALEC actually had, you know, some beneficial value where they were bringing model legislation that would help people. Now it's all about their corporate donors or corporate members. It's, you know, each corporate member pays a minimum of $25,000 just to be able to wine and dine the legislators who go to the ALEC convention. And tonight they're having a big gala celebrating themselves, which is just, you know, the irony is thick in this town tonight. But it's really about making the 1% richer.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, those corporate entities, they're people. Didn't you know that?
Well, that's the funny thing about it. If you ask the Supreme Court right now, which I hate to say is compromised because of the amount of corporate money that has influenced them over the years, we have Clarence Thomas, whose wife is actually at the head of an organization that belongs to ALEC and is active in ALEC. And, you know, these are judges that, by and large, have been on the side of corporate law since early in their careers because a lot of them were corporate lawyers. And so it's not a surprise that they would come down on the side of the corporation. I think long term we're going to be able to push that back, but it's going to take a real people movement to get a constitutional amendment saying that corporations are not people.
Man, you know, you listen to what you're saying here, and you know, I bring it back to Pennsylvania. I guess what we've got to look forward to is more legislation to help the frackers. It wasn't enough that they passed a piece of legislation that barred local communities from having any say in where companies frack. No, local control, not here in Pennsylvania. It's not bad enough that they've stripped $3 billion from public education and are starving it so that the profiteers can come in and privatize it. It's not bad enough that they proposed privatizing our lottery and selling off the wine and spirit shops. I can't wait to see what they come back with next, Scott.
Well, that's what we're going to find out over the next 3-4 days, Rick. You know, the good thing about ALEC is that they try to influence everybody. And so the people that are our friendlies who are inside the convention as we speak and are going to be inside these meetings are going to be funneling that information back to organizations like People for the American Way, Common Cause, Center for Media and Democracy. And we'll be writing a lot more data out there and informing the people about exactly what these pieces of template legislation are and what they're going to mean to the average voter and the average worker. Because at the end of the day, if we don't have the information and we don't get it out there, we can't do something about it.
No.
So we've got to make these legislators chagrined to even think of introducing a piece of ALEC model legislation, whether it's Pennsylvania or Illinois or Michigan or Wisconsin. We've got to make them ashamed to even be involved or associated with it.
And when that comes out, we want you back here on the program to expose that so we can go after those folks and call them onto the floor and hold them accountable. Because at the end of the day, I've yet to find any of these privatization schemes that groups like ALEC push that have benefited people like me or working folks like me. I mean, I've been asking for 8 years on the air now. Show me something that we've privatized that works better, costs less, and has done a sufficient job for we the people. And yet, not once in 8 years, big surprise, has anyone said, hey, I know something. Can you think of anything that we've privatized and profitized that's somehow been better for we the people? Because I can't.
I can't either, Rick. And you know, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, they've all been cities who have been victims of the privatization movement. Here in Chicago, one of the biggest problems that people point out is the sale of the Chicago Skyway to a private corporation or
the parking
meter fiasco.
Yeah.
And I know Philadelphia is going through this same sort of privatization movement, and it's really driven by ALEC-related legislators. And, you know, they have a stranglehold on Harrisburg right now.
You bet you they do. They're trying to privatize our parking here. And one of the things that I keep saying is don't wish that away, because I look what they did in Pittsburgh. And part of the contract they had there in Pittsburgh when they privatized the parking system is they said, you can't expand public transportation without us suing you.
Right.
I mean, so by signing these privatization schemes, we actually tie our hands and hamper our ability to move in the future and make decisions for our community in the future, which I got to be honest, I think groups like ALEC foresee years into the future, because these are well-paid, bright thinking people who think of every scheme and every way of profiting for themselves. I think this is stuff that's all pre-planned.
It really is. And that's why we're highlighting this 40th anniversary, because it's really 40 years of squeezing working people, and it's 4 years of squeezing the 99% in favor of rich millionaires and billionaires like the Koch brothers. And, you know, this town right now is full of rich lobbyists, and these rich lobbyists do not get paid to sit around and not think in the future. In fact, they get paid to think well down the road to make sure that their clients make profit and make that linkage between legislative activity and corporate profit.
Yep.
It's a vicious cycle. It's something that we at People for the American Way are committed to fighting back against. And ultimately, it comes down to real democracy. Are we going to sell every best asset we have, the minds of our children, the jobs that we have, or are we going to protect certain things for our democracy by keeping them democratic?
And that's why I'm glad, Scott, that you're there, and I'm glad there are thousands of people in the streets there in Chicago to draw attention to this and to highlight the fact that this group, this ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the things that they're doing. And I can't wait to have you come back. Tell us what you find out so that we can prepare for the battles ahead.
Absolutely.
Scott Fogel, I appreciate the time. Regional Political Coordinator for People for the American Way. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Keep fighting, Rick.
All righty. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
One of these days we want to wake up.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Good fences make good neighbors, goes the old adage. That civilizing thought refers to such friendly structures as the rock fences of New England and whitewashed pickets of the Midwest. But the neighborly adage definitely did not contemplate the 700-mile, 20-foot-high, drone-patrolled, electronically monitored steel and razor wire barricade that our government has erected across our nation's border with Mexico. This thing is not a fence, but a monstrous wall of hostility, a deliberate affront to our Mexican neighbors. As Senator John McCain aptly put it, we have the most militarized border since the fall of the Berlin Wall. There are four big flaws with the theory that you can secure a border by throwing up a big old wall. First, it doesn't work. A 20-foot wall quickly begets 22-foot ladders. People determined to get in or out will find many inventive ways to do it. Second, walls create bigger problems than they resolve, for they are deeply divisive. Our Mexican wall is ugly, both literally and in the unmistakable message of contempt it screams at the Mexican people. It's generating bitterness toward us, and that turns neighbors into enemies. Third, that wall has physically ripped previously united cross-border families, friends, businesses, and cities apart, weakening both sides. Fourth, such walls are insanely expensive. So far, Washington has hurled tens of billions of dollars at this one to build, maintain, and police it, and states have dumped billions more into it. Can these policymakers even spell W-A-S-T-E? Yet, the U.S. Senate recently voted to waste another $46 billion to build 700 more miles of the hateful wall and double the number of militarized border agents. This is Jim Hightower saying, is there no other need in our country for that money? Nothing constructive we might do with it?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Let me say this as emphatically as I can. Who cares about Mitt Romney's tax returns? Secondly, I love the fact that the guy is rich. You got people who are trying to make it seem like being rich is bad.
There's one guy that I got to be honest, I missed the Herman Cain train. I do. I'm one of those people who I found him to be very comical. He was funny, destructive, dangerous, but still, to me, funny as hell. It's just a laugh a minute. He's somebody I wouldn't mind seeing in Congress. Honestly, I mean, you might as well. I mean, it's a cluster now anyway. It's the Keystone Cops now anyway. Nothing actually gets done in the House. So it would be fun to have someone entertaining you know, as insane as Louis Gohmert is, as crazy as Michelle Bachmann is, there's still some entertainment value. Alan West, still some, when he was there, some major entertainment value. Insanity sells, I think. I just think it's a fun thing. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Fine, Rick. How about yourself?
Oh, I cannot complain. Cannot complain. Good to see people in the streets in Chicago letting Alec know somebody's watching.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They got a ear from the people, man, and they don't represent the people. That's the 1%.
Well, they represent corporate people. And those are really the only people they think that matter.
Right. Hey, you were talking about the post office earlier. I just can't believe that the Democrats even let that happen. You know, there's something called a filibuster. You think when they put that bill through, that might have been the time to use it? You know, to stop that from happening?
Understand, Andy. You know, Democrats, they don't like gumming up the system. They, you know, they'll compromise. And I've said this before, you know, the Republicans keep pushing the goalpost further and further and further, and then the Democrats always compromise halfway. And they
right.
This is a learned response. And I think my analogy of, you know, the Republicans saying, you know, we're going to kill you, and you go, no, no, compromise, just cut off my lower half.
Right, the battered wife syndrome.
Or, as I say, the Stockholm syndrome. I mean, we now identify
thing.
With our captors.
Exactly. You know, you think with the post office, too, you could open that up and put more services like they do in Europe. You know, you could just, like, put a bank in there, have a state bank. I mean, that would be the perfect avenue with all that property running around. Or, you know, expand it more to compete with UPS and FedEx. Or even sell insurance or do something like that, I mean.
Well, now you've found the government part of this. All of the operation of it is, you know, is kind of like a private business that doesn't get any federal money. It doesn't get any help federally, but it does have federal mandates of things that it can and things that it cannot do, and a mandate that it has to go to every single address in this country that no other business has, which I think is a good thing.
Absolutely, that's what Ben Franklin set it up for.
And
I mean,
what
you have to have that.
And what they're doing
going
with
out to people.
And what they're doing with this now is they're breaking that part of it, and they're going to say, oh, we'll have these cluster boxes, or maybe we'll put a cluster of them in the Walmart store, or you can, Andy, if you want home delivery, you can pay for it, just like you do with the newspaper.
Right, what baloney. Well, boy, the only way a republic could possibly function is people have to have access to information, and the
yep.
only way they're going to get information in rural areas at a reasonable price, it has got to be subsidized by the government.
But even this, Andy, you know, but here's the thing, and I agree with you on the subsidized part, but there's no subsidies here. If you take away this bizarre poison pill mandate that the Republicans rammed down our throats in 2006, you take this 75-year mandate away, they're profitable. They made $1.5 billion. They're fine. Their business model is fine without the poison pill.
Well, at least I've heard, according to the way the income statement, at least it's a heck of a lot better than it is with that. I mean, you're definitely correct that the poison pill, it's there to destroy the post office. At least without that, they have a fighting chance of getting things under control.
But here again, the compromise, because here Democrats are going to find, oh, let's, instead of saying repeal it, get rid of it, I mean, do you see the Republicans saying, hey, let's compromise on Obamacare? Hell no. 40 to 60 votes on repealing it? They understand Democrats aren't going to do this to save the post office. Oh, well, let's compromise. We'll open the door like Carper's doing. We'll open the door to, you know, you can... You know, you can, if you want to, you know, cut the number of days, and if you want to down the road, limit, be able to have clusters instead of going to everyone's home, you can do that down the road. I mean, it's opening the door.
Well, it's the leadership, man. You know that. It's the leadership. Mr. Obama is so weak-kneed and jellyfish-like without a backbone that the Democrats have just blew their brand. They soiled their brand. They stand for nothing. You know, all they do is, like you said, you listen to some of his speeches, it's compromise, compromise, compromise. I mean, it's insane. And what's going on with this Amazon speech? Talk about outrageous.
Yeah, I mean,
a company like Amazon, no living wage, abuse, exploitation, no benefits. I mean, what is that? That's our jobs of the future? What kind of crud is that giving a speech there? What is that guy thinking, man? Is there rats running around in Obama's head now? Is that what's up there, man?
I got to think that it's who he's hanging out with, man. He doesn't have a beer with a guy like you or me. He only hears what the Wall Street crowd tell him and what the captains of industry are telling him. To me,
right.
And look, I mean, I'm told we're probably the only program in the country that covered that speech the way we did, with outrage and disdain for the fact that you go to a place where they use temporary employees with no benefits. Are you kidding me? And that's the wave of the future?
I was outraged. Outraged. I couldn't believe it. I'm glad you were. I know you were outraged, too. I know.
And look, I voted for the guy. I'll be honest about it. I voted for him. I voted for him in 2008. I voted against Romney in 2012. I think I've been quite clear about that. But, you know, he got my vote. Now the question is, how do we push him in the direction that we need him to go? Which to me means you get to the ballot box here next year, you vote in a Congress that's going to push him in that direction. Because I think he is. I think he's malleable. I think if you put something in front of him that's going to help, I think he signs it. But you got to get the people there who are going to push it.
Well, you say it show after show. You got to get the people out in the streets. You got to show that the people are outraged. You got to surround that White House. That's the only way. It's got to be consistent. Consistently, we got to get out there. You know, that's the only way they're going to understand. And like the last jobs report, too, 85,000 of those 165,000 jobs were low-wage jobs in the restaurant, leisure sector. I mean, that's insane. The jobs we're creating are low-wage, non-benefit, non-living-wage jobs. It's incredible. Obama's not. He is not getting the job done.
Well, and now let me step back and defend him a little bit. The Republicans won't let him do anything. Even if he wanted to do something that we would agree with, they're no way in hell ever going to do it, which makes me go, if you're in that situation, if it's me, if Rick Smith's sitting in that White House and I know the Republicans aren't going to do anything, I'm pushing the goalposts as far out to the extreme as I can possibly push them so that you start pushing to say, hey, okay, well, why don't you compromise?
Right. Well, I'd be saying card check every day. Let's do card check. Let's have a bill up there. Let's keep pushing it.
Absolutely.
Let's keep pushing it. Let's make this a union country again, man, where unions can thrive like they do just across the border in Canada. What, 40% of the workforce is unionized in Canada?
Yeah, well, not just unions. It's workers.
It's like 60 or 70% in Sweden and Germany.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
And you look
there's
at the
workers. There's something structurally wrong that's killing us. It's killing us.
Well,
it's killing the average working man. You know that.
Yeah, well, what we've done is we've created the largest billionaire class in history, and they don't want to give up any of the power.
No question. Agreed. Totally agree with you. And that's why you brought up Alec before. That's the tip of the spear right there for those folks.
And to me, all of this is an education process because you talk to the average American voter, they don't know who the hell Alec is. They don't
right.
know the forces that have been pushing this anti-worker, pro-business agenda. All they know is what they hear on their local news, which is all owned by big multi-state, multinational corporations who want to push like the Washington Post owning Kaplan University. How many people know that?
Right. Right. Yeah, Kaplan's got his tentacles all over the place in the for-profit school industry.
And it's not bad enough that they've corrupted and they've destroyed higher ed. They want to get their tentacles down in K-12 and preschool. And then you got Christine Quinn there in New York City, who's probably going to be mayor of New York, saying, "Oh, well, we'll give loans so people can send their kids to preschool, so kids are going to get out of preschool with student loan debt."
Oh, Jesus.
And that's a Democrat doing it, Andy.
Right, right. Well, that's a matter of opinion whether that's a Democrat or not.
That's somebody with the D after their name. Which again,
yeah, that's,
I think we both agree we need to straighten the party out a little bit.
Absolutely. There's a lot of bad neoliberal Democrats just following in the heels of Mr. Obama. And you've listed them. You've listed the names, man. You know, they're out there, and we got to stop that. We got to get them out of there. Got to get the good Democrats, the progressive, the Alan Graysons. We got to model. We got to do a clones of Alan Grayson, man. That's what we need. We just need more of him. People that are real, you know, real fighters.
Yep.
Real fighters.
Somebody you want to get into a street, you want to on your side in the street fight. I've always said that, you know, I got to be honest, there are very few Democrats I want on my side in the street fight.
Yeah, well, Alan Grayson's bigger than you, so we can use more like that. Matter of fact, too, I got to say to your audience, you look much better in person than you do on your video, man.
Well,
you're in great shape.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
You're looking good in San Jose.
Yeah, we really enjoyed coming out. It was great meeting you and great being there at Netroots Nation. The tour was fantastic. But I got to be honest, I'm glad I'm back home and back in the studio.
No, I'll bet. You were really hitting it hard. That's tough traveling that much. And I know you guys were on a tight schedule.
Yeah, but we had an absolute ball. And if anyone missed our tour, the People's Tour for America.com is where we've got pictures and interviews and all kind of stuff there to be looked at and treasured for generations to come, because it was really a great opportunity for me and my family, Andy. And like I said, it was great meeting you and everyone out there at Netroots Nation too.
Good. Did you get to ride the BART system while you were here?
I didn't. I wanted to, but I didn't get the chance.
Right. Do you know that they brought in a union buster too?
Yeah, I've heard.
A guy named Tom Hawks.
Yeah,
from
I've heard. We're trying to get some people out there to come out and talk about what's going on there.
Yeah, you ought to. It's really shady. It's a bad situation.
What's interesting to me though is you look out there. They're talking about putting in more rail, but they don't want to deal with the workers that they have now, the bus drivers.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to skimp on everything, especially the safety aspect. They let a lot of workers go that were in the safety area that were proficient there. You know, it's everywhere. They just grind the workers down. They try to get as much out of them as they possibly can without paying the benefits and wages. And you look at the wages and the pensions, and they're so low for the rank and file. And the people at the top of these agencies are making top dollar.
Yep.
You know, tremendous salaries, tremendous benefits, and it's so top heavy. But you look at the rank and file, that guy's going to retire with the average pension of $21,000. Big deal.
Yeah, here in Pennsylvania, it's $18,000.
Big deal.
It's $18,000 for some state workers. And, you know, there was today the contract for the Harrisburg teachers was just ratified, and they took a 5% pay cut. And the local media said, they teased out their story saying, local teachers take a lesson in subtraction. Like, that's a good thing.
Well, 80% of CalPERS, which is the whole state pension fund, which BART is part of, 80% of the beneficiaries in that are only going to get $36,000.
Which for California is not a whole lot of money.
No, tops. 80% of the beneficiaries, wow. $36,000. I mean, it's ridiculous. Again, it's skewed because some people at the top are making huge amounts. You know, there's some people that just spend their careers and they get to a high level and they skew the numbers immensely. But the vast majority of people are not coming out in a grand way, especially living, like you said, in the high rent district here.
Yeah, and now they want to steal that even. And I'm watching what's going on in Detroit, and we'll be covering more of that in the coming days, weeks, and months. Andy, it's really great talking with you. I appreciate the call. I got to take a quick break here, but thanks.
All right, Rick. Keep up the great work, man.
Call
solidarity,
back.
Man.
Solidarity, brother. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We got to get over tonight. We got to do it today. No more kindness.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate.
new, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, things have gone absolutely berserk when you look at a restaurant out in Los Angeles. It's called Ray's and Stark's Bar. They have a brand new menu item. They actually have a water menu. They've got 20 different varieties of water. I honestly don't really know where to go with that other than the fact that they have a water tasting for $12. When I was a kid, there was a drinking fountain. Now we have, things have gone really, really insane. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. We've got Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, what do you think? $12 for a water tasting?
Well, in the mid-70s, I sat in a club called Panage at Ohio State, and I remember when they had Perrier, and I said, they'll never sell water. Well, here we go.
You know, because I grew up as a kid, there were water fountains everywhere.
Sure.
You wanted a drink of water, there was a water fountain there. And again, it was back to what we used to do for ourselves as a public. We were thirsty. We wanted something to drink. Bang, there it was. Now it's been privatized and profitized.
Maybe it's apocalyptic, like the Mel Gibson Mad Max movies. Maybe they're going to be selling water in the future.
Well, I don't doubt that. I do believe we're going to, at some point in my lifetime, we will be fighting wars over water. They're already doing it now, but I think here in the U.S., because there was a time not too long ago, a couple of years back, where Florida and Georgia were about ready to go to war over Lake Lanier. Mm-hmm. And you look at the Colorado River, you know, some of the states over there, not all too pleased about the way that's being allocated. Right. You could see at some point some skirmishes going on over, because you oil we can live without. Water,
well, Texas,
not so much.
Texas might have to be nice to Mexico.
Well, Mexico is just polluting the hell out of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the thing is, you know, oil we could probably live without. We could figure that. Water, you really, honestly, you can't live without. So it blows my mind that we even consider privatizing it. Just is what it is. So let's move along. The president has canceled his talks with Putin.
Yes, you know, Putin's turned out to be a big disappointment. Of course, he's went towards the KGB thug approach versus, and that comes from a lot of people in Russia and outside. But the Snowden issue about a month ago, you know, the president was saying, well, I'm not going to directly call him. It hasn't risen to that level, but I think it's risen to this level and serious part of it. But I think White House staff, from what I picked up anyway, said, you know, wouldn't be good if you met privately, and then with the Snowden issue going. But they've eventually got to meet. They have to meet because there are issues out there beyond Snowden.
Right.
So it's eventually a matter of time. To go back into a complete Cold War would be really not well.
Yeah, but you know, is anyone surprised that Putin is what he is? I mean, there's no surprise. I mean, we're talking years now of knowing that he is what he is. And now we're just coming around to he is what he is.
Well, you know, President Bush, when he first got in, it was Putin this and Putin that. I mean, I'm I was on Air Force One and heard all the way to Ohio about Putin. And everybody had this idea that Putin was some kind of different human being, but he just never was. And he put up this front for a couple of years, and then the old KGB just started rushing out.
Yeah, I remember the Bush quote, kindred souls or something.
Oh, yeah.
Something along that lines, and, you know, they looked into each other's souls. Yeah, I seem to remember, you know, them driving around in the little Volkswagen and all that. Yeah.
It was like the Peaches and Herb song, Reunited, you know.
There you go. But again, you know, not to go after, you know, President Bush, but I do believe they were kindred souls. Putin is what he is, and I believe Bush wasn't too far off of that path if we would have him as well. But I guess he's out of the hospital today, correct?
Yes. He's had the stent put in. You know, it's amazing when things happen, and sometimes the comments you see, and people were sending around emails, but I think most Americans obviously are wishing him well.
Yeah, I don't wish him any ill. You know,
sure.
That's, you know.
Right.
His charges are, you know, he's the God Squatter. I'm sure will come in the afterlife. Any of the negative stuff that you may think, I wish ill on no one, because
right.
I believe in that whole karma thing.
I do, too, and that's why sometimes I had emails from people on President Obama, which I, you know, sent in messages, don't send those. I mean, some of the people can, you know, disagree, but my goodness, some of it's really bad.
Yeah, some of it's just ridiculous. Let's talk about the big news. The Republicans talking about it since they're home. You know, John Boehner was in town here recently raising money for one of the local congressmen, you know, doing the whole Tea Party thing. Didn't go to the level of we're shutting down the government, but some Republican congressmen are saying we want to shut it down. Good idea, bad idea? You were there the last time. Thoughts?
Well, it's not going to happen, but they're walking a thin line because Mitch McConnell is the Republican leader of the Senate. He's got a primary, so he has to kind of Tea Party his way through the primary, and he's got a lot of money. But once he does that, then he won't be for a government shutdown, you know, once he gets through the primary circa. I was there when the last one happened. Different scenario. We had a Republican-controlled Senate, and Bob Dole blinked on it, and the rest is history. President Clinton's numbers did drop for a while, but they catapulted back up. The bottom line is, it's a little bit different too, Rick, because they're talking about shutting the government down for one issue.
Yep.
When we shut the government down before, at least for what it's worth, it was a broad, generic, you know, balance the budget. This is not even balance the budget. This is get Obamacare.
Yeah, this
whole
is
different animal they're trying to put out there that's not going to sell. So they're breathing fire, but some of the senators are backing off of it. They're just trying to do it quietly.
I think they have to. I mean, even when you got Mitt Romney coming out saying, well,
yes,
it wouldn't be a good idea. There's other ways to starve Obamacare. Don't do this because you're going to lose. And he was quite forthright with his statements.
Yes, he was. And that hit big today, and the timing of it, I think, is pretty good.
You know, and, you know, this idea that, but to me, you know, when I hear Mitt Romney, who could have been president, saying there are other ways to destroy this health care and take health care from 32 million people who don't have it today, you know, I start going, you know, what exactly is the Republican Party standing for? What's the alternative? You want to repeal it, tell me what you replace it with. Pay or die didn't work, so what do you replace it with?
The problem with the health care bill is that it was cobbled together and could have been much, much better, but they still have room to tweak it. It's the law of the land. Supreme Court spoke. The Republicans' problem is going to be this. If they do decimate it or, you know, take it backwards or destroy it or whatever, what are they going to replace it with? Because you have this huge gap of people who are, you know, mainly working people. Let's face it, if your income's gone, you can get a card, a medical card. So these are a lot of people that, if the Republicans think about it, actually might be voters towards them. But beyond the votes, it's the citizenry that's going to have this huge gap of people that have nothing. So if you're going to take something away, you have to replace it with something, and they don't have that replacement.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything other than freedom and liberty. And I'm going, well, that's great. I'm with you. I love freedom. I love liberty. Those are great concepts and great ideas. But how does that, if I have a heart attack, how does that save me?
It doesn't.
And it's, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I wish we'd get our heads around. Because to me, I'm not thrilled with Obamacare either. There are a ton of things I would like to see change with it. I got to be honest, I was a Medicare for all person. I believe in single payer. But, you know, that didn't happen either. So you don't hear me screaming, repeal it because I want single payer. No, let's work through this. Let's find out what works, just like we did with Medicare. The exact same thing in my view.
And Ohio did private sector reform way back in 1992, but it really had to push to do it. It was done on a bipartisan basis, and that was private sector reform. But, you know, the feds never did private sector reform. Had they done private sector reform, we probably wouldn't even have the word Obamacare today.
Yep.
But they just sat and did nothing. Hastert, speaker, tried to, but it just all fell apart.
You know, but I go back to when Clinton tried this, and a lot of what is in Obamacare is what the Republicans of the time were suggesting in opposition to what Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton came up with. So they basically got what they wanted just 20 years later.
Well, it is interesting how things certainly changed. I look back at the freshman class, you know, the Contract with America class, and again, Lindsey Graham was in that class, and who would have thought that today people would be calling him a liberal or a moderate?
He's still a war hawk to me, and he's in Egypt. He and McCain are both in Egypt. What's going on there?
Well, it's kind of a good cop, bad cop in a sense. You know, the administration is doing a tap dance. Is it a coup? Is it not a coup? And they're doing that because nobody wants to cut off, you know, Egypt's money. And McCain and Graham are over there trying to push for elections. They're also trying to say, you know, somewhat to the opposition, well, you know, they shouldn't be more arrests, and they should come along. That's not going to work. Mercy supporters are not going to accept anything. But I think at least the positive thing that might come out of it is they push elections along, and we can get past this coup thing.
Right.
But, you know, after all, the Congress passed that monster. You know, if you have a coup, your money's shut off. Well, nobody ever thought, well, I wonder if you have a coup that leads to a better result. And now they can't change the law, so now they're trying to step around it.
No, we can't seem to do anything.
Nothing.
So, you know, what's going on in Yemen? I mean, the last time, you know, the last to hear you, they're closing the embassies and all the stuff across the Middle East. What's the latest there?
There's a lot of speculation that, you know, what we'll be doing this for. Some of the neocon ultra-right pundits were saying that this shows we're weak. But Yemen has announced that it has stopped some terrorist activities, which would have been along the pipeline, taking control of some cities by al-Qaeda, some definite real threats. And those were threats even beyond the American embassy and Americans themselves. So there was a dual threat situation. I believe it absolutely shows that this was a real deal. This was not inspired because they wanted to, you know, prove the NSA correct. This was a real deal. Now, maybe they overextended a bit on, you know, a little closing of more embassies. But again, darned if you do, darned if you don't. But the approach was correct on Yemen, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, because what happens if you have another Benghazi? Then what hearings? Then what finger pointing? Then what's the word then? Oh, you didn't do enough. I mean, you really can't win in this situation, can you?
No, we went through this in the Capitol, and they wanted to shut the entire Capitol down and do this and do that, and we you know, compromised on and shut some tours down on the anniversary of 9/11, but. You know, one of the security people I remember at that time said to me, well, you know, if something happens, it's your fault. And I said, okay, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you can't win. So the White House, you know, had to take the approach they did. They're opening some embassies now quicker. But I believe this Yemen announcement today by the Yemeni government, who are trying to help and stop this, proves that the threat was absolutely real.
Yeah, the one thing I missed from the Bush years, I got to be honest with you, I missed the code red. I missed the color-coded terror.
Oh, my Lord. What was his name? The former governor.
Tom Ridge.
Oh, Tom Ridge. My goodness.
You're in Pennsylvania here. We know Tom intimately. In fact, his lobbying headquarters is just across the street from our studio here. So we get to see the Shale Shill's office every chance we get.
You ought to look up what he was paid to support the MEK Mojahideen group, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that's over most Pennsylvania voters' head.
That's right.
Just sad stuff. But on the Benghazi thing, I see that the Department of Justice filed murder charges against Ahmed Abu Kalalala.
Kalalani. And they also have 12 others who they're not naming because if they do, it hurts our ability to track them. And then somebody said today, asked the question, well, why do they have to do this? Well, they do it because, you know, if they find these people in the other countries, they can't just say, oh, wait a minute, hang on to them so we can go ahead and do a legal process. They have to do this so that we have the ability to say, you know, extradition and to do something on a legal basis.
Absolutely. And finally, the shooting down at Fort Hood, the trial, you know, started, I guess, yesterday, was it?
Yeah.
Where the guy said, well, I'm the guy, but I'm going to make some stuff up.
Well, he wanted to question the very people he shot, and luckily the judge has said, you know, appropriately, I should put, has said, no, you're not going to do that. And he said, I want the death penalty, and they couldn't accept his guilty plea because they were going after the death penalty, which probably honestly won't happen that it'll ever be executed, but the trial has just turned in such a direction. This guy really is showing what a monster he is.
I mean, at the end of this, isn't this the argument against trying a lot of these guys in U.S. courts?
Oh, yeah. It turns in a direction that they use this to inspire others overseas, you know, to be the quote martyrs for the cause. And it's just a travesty.
But here's the thing, and this is, you know, I've thought about this quite a bit. As much as I hate this scenario, this situation, I still think our system is right, and I still, there's part of me that goes, you still have the right to confront your accusers, and as much as I hate the fact that he would be able to question the witnesses against him, I still think that's our system, though. I'm curious your thought.
Well, the problem is, if he had an attorney who's schooled, Lord knows what this guy will say,
right.
And they could rule him out of order. But if he had an attorney, and I mean, an attorney would actually ask some questions. But I think the way this guy's mental condition is probably what would lead to a not so good question.
Couldn't you just then say that he's not, you know, he's not capable? Well, I guess if he's not capable to defend himself, he's not capable to stand trial, and that would be an insanity defense, then, wouldn't it?
But you know, you make a good point. I mean, overall, too, people say, well, just take him out and shoot him. Well, you have to have a trial.
No, I mean,
if somebody wants a trial, you've got to have it. Because when we go down that path and we lead to the Guantanamo Bays and the drone strike questions, et cetera.
No, I think our system, even when you have little glicks like this,
that's right.
I still think it is the best possible way to go. And as much as I hate it, it is what it is. But I didn't know that the judge had ruled that he wasn't able to question, which I'm not quite sure how I feel about it, actually. So we'll see. Anyway, Bob, it's always great talking with you.
Appreciate the
time.
Take care.
Our good friend Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back. You gave me fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things I can go.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
How can we be a people that fight for America if we don't know who America is or what we're all about? This is, in my opinion, a conscious effort on the part of the left, who has a huge influence on our curriculum, to desensitize America to what American values are, so they're more pliable to the new values that they would like to impose on America.
You know, I gotta be honest, there's part of me that wishes he would just go away. But, you know, here's the thing. When he comes back, it's always a gem. And he was at an event, Students for Life. I would have to argue probably people who are fairly obsessed, if you're going to show up at a Students for Life rally. And he went into this bizarre, weird spiel. Here's a bit of it.
You see, what the left does, what the pro-choice movement does, is they just don't focus on their little issue. They focus on everything they do and every aspect of their life.
You mean they care about their issue, and you know they actually live what they preach, and they actually believe what they say, and all of that? Really?
They make it uncomfortable for students who come to Austin to shower at a young men's Christian association.
How exactly did they do that, Rick?
YMCA gym. Because they live it.
They live it.
They're passionate.
Passionate.
They're willing to do and say uncomfortable things in mixed company. They're willing to make the sacrifice at their business because they care enough.
Unlike you people who don't. You people don't care enough. No, they care. They actually believe what they're saying. Obviously, you people don't.
We won the American Revolution not against those British, not because we were the most powerful, not because we had the most arms, not because we had the truth. We won because we wanted it more. We were willing to sacrifice everything for it.
And just to be clear, the French helped. A point of contention there. The French helped, just a little bit, but he goes on.
And we were not going to give up. We were not going to stop. That's how the left has done to America what you've seen in your lifetime. Because they simply won't give up.
And I think that's a good thing. And the left that he sees, I wish were larger. And I wish more people who believed passionately about better working conditions, better wages, a healthcare, education, all of those things, I wish those people would be just as passionate in the streets, because evidently, according to Rick Santorum, people who like him, they don't believe. They're not passionate enough, which I find very interesting. And I guess, he's kind of obsessed. I mean, you look at his wife who, dated an abortion doctor, left him because didn't want kids, then left a previous boyfriend because he didn't want to have kids. How would you feel that if you were third in line? I kind of like Rick Santorum, I guess. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com or Stitcher on the smartphone. See you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and